You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio this week, Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern, as you know, was a CIA analyst for 27 years, from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. His duties included chairing national intelligence estimates and preparing the president's daily brief, which he briefed one-on-one to President Reagan's five most senior national security advisors from 1981 to 1985. In January 2003, Ray McGovern co-created Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose how intelligence was being falsified to justify war on Iraq. His website is raymcgovern.com. Lots of interesting articles there in recent days that we will be talking about. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
It's great to have you back. You've been writing about lots of topics, one of them being arms control or the lack thereof, and of course, U.S.-Russian relations. What should people know that CNN isn't telling them?
How much time do we have, David?
We got 28 minutes.
I'm joshing, of course. There's a lot that people don't know who depend on the New York Times and CNN. Or even, you know, even progressive websites now who get foreign affairs wrong. I won't name them, but the initials would be Democracy Now. let me just start with Putin's major address. Okay, this is a State of the Nation address on the 1st of March. It was really something. Not only did he advertise a whole new generation of strategic weaponry, which he claimed, and no one has disproved, would render the billions of dollars that we have wasted on anti-ballistic missile defenses, render them useless. They're useless to begin with, most scientists and engineers say, but these new weapons that he advertised, and some of which he said are operational, would have done that. Now, that's what caught all the attention, but he also said, all right, now, we tried to get you to listen to us. You wouldn't listen to us. Now, hopefully you listen to us. Let's get together at the appropriate time with experts and figure out how we address these problems. In other words, talk on arms control. Whoa. Now, that has piqued most people's attention, but that was an offer.
Okay, that was a real offer. Now, a couple of days later, he's talking about the strategic relationship, and somebody says, "Now, Mr. Putin, this is an interview. It's March the 7th now, so 6 days later." Somebody says, "Hey, listen, Mr. Putin, why would you destroy the whole world? You know, why would if there were a first strike on Russia, would you really respond and, you know?" I mean, be too late to save Russia. You know, he says, look, he says, yeah, this would be a global catastrophe, but, quote, as a citizen of Russia and as the head of the Russian state, I ask, quote, what need would we have for a world if there was no Russia, end quote, okay? So he's saying, look, you got to take this stuff seriously. Yes, we would retaliate, even if it meant the rest of the world will be blown up, as well as Russia. 2 days later, four senior senators, okay? Look at three Democrats, see if I can remember them, Feinstein, Wyden, a fellow up there in Massachusetts, and Bernie Sanders, they issue a call. A letter to then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Look, this is really getting out of hand. We don't like the fact that Putin is brandishing these weapons that we really have never heard of before, but he's calling for arms control talks, so let's talk for that. Let's talk. Now, guess what? That appeal
appeared on everyone's, all those four senators' websites, it was totally, totally ignored by what passes for the mainstream media. So one suspects that this is an unwelcome subject, and there is proof positive. Last thing I'll mention, we were talking about four senior senators appealing for arms control talks on their websites, but never getting past their websites, no publicity for it, thinking that Chuck Schumer said, no, arms control, no, when we're making the devil incarnate, as Vladimir Putin, don't mention arms control talks. Okay, so that's the reality in the mainstream media. Now, when Trump had the audacity to say, Putin won the election, he's going to be around for six more years, probably I'll send him a congratulatory telegram. I mean, that's totally good for such situations. So his staff says, no, don't congratulate him. No, don't congratulate him. Okay. Well, he not only congratulates him, but he says, the situation is such that we really ought to get together sooner rather than later, and we ought to talk about arms control. Now, for those of your audience who listen to the New York Times website or will read what's in the New York Times, they're totally oblivious to that because the Times cut out. They had a lead. They had a title or a headline saying Trump calls for arms control talks. Now, that lasted 2 hours. So what I'm trying to say here is that the only conclusion here is the old hackneyed military, industrial, congressional, intelligence, media complex. Now, you ran a conference on the 50th anniversary of Eisenhower's speech, military industrial complex. Well, it's gotten worse, astronomically worse. And the people who make the arms, the people who sell the arms, the people that Pope Francis, to his credit, before Congress 2.5 years ago, call the blood-drenched arms traders, those are the people that are running the show. And the people, Putin and his folks are sitting back in Moscow, and they're saying, whoa, we thought the military-industrial complex had a hold on Obama, and we were right. Now it looks even worse.
Ray McGovern, it seems to me like if indeed they are two separate things, the sort of tag team effort of the Russiagate promoters and the weapons promoters and those who have intentionally exaggerated the Russian threat since before the administration of President Kennedy, have a couple of big victories in recent days. One being Trump's missiles into Damascus, but the other being getting Putin to crow about new dangerous weapons. I mean, this has got to be great news from the perspective of people trying to stir up hostility with Russia and sell weapons, right?
Yeah, it cuts both ways. For Putin to see what's going on in Washington, namely that the President of the United States really doesn't seem to be his own man, okay? Not only that, but he has a certifiably insane national security advisor, and I can prove that. He was among the people called, quote, the crazies, end quote, when I was working with President or then CIA director and later Vice President George H.W. Bush. I have it in a note from him. I try to warn him. I said, Mr. President, we had a little correspondence well after he left the presidency and I left the agency. We had a decent relationship, a personal one. We were friends. So I said 2 months before, 2 months before the attack on Iraq, Mr. President, please, you know why you kept, quote, the crazies, end quote, at bay. But why you didn't let them occupy positions of influence where they could start a war or do really stupid things. Would you please, this is the 11th of January, 2003, would you please tell your son why it was that we all call these people, quote, the crazies and why you kept them at arm's length, because it looks like he's gonna start a war in the influence of, under the influence of these guys. You know, there were Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, so all these people that, you know, would you please tell him? Well, on the 22nd of January in his summer website, he wrote back a little note, handwritten note, and he said, you know, Ray, thanks for your letter. I too was wondering. It was going around about that my son would be under the influence of, quote, the crazies, end quote. But I don't think it's true now. And you know, just kind of relax, okay? So this is 2 months before the attack on Iraq. Yeah. The point I'm trying to make is that everyone in the 70s, 80s, halfway through the 90s, referred to these guys as the crazies. And here is John Bolton, who was crazy enough to advise the younger Bush to get out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which had been the bedrock, had been the cornerstone of strategic stability since 1972. And I was there in Moscow, and that was signed. It introduced, yeah, sure, it was a kind of a strange phenomenon where you had a balance of terror where neither side thought that they could get away with a first strike. But that was a heck of a lot better than an unbalance without any strategic disincentive to start a first strike. So this is all coming to roost now. And John Bolton, if you ask me, why was it that early in the morning President Trump wrote this ridiculous tweet saying, aha, yeah, the Russians say they can shoot down our missiles. Ha ha, well, we'll see about that. We have smart missiles. We have new missiles. Well, we'll get a show to Russians. Who wrote that? I mean, as odd as Trump is, Bolton is the first one to see him in the morning and the last one to see him at night. My bet is that Bolton wrote that, and then the president was committed to doing something. What he did was a feckless sort of thing, thanks to the, you know, to the fact that his military advisors put the brakes on it and made darn sure that he didn't hit any Russians or any Iranians. So Bolton's right there. And what I'm trying to say is here, Putin's looking at all this. He knows who the crazies are. And he knows that Bolton has a lot of influence. And so this is a very destabilizing thing, because when the Russians keep telling us, look, we got these missiles, these new weapons, well, you know, the press says, well, they're faking it. They're probably faking it. Well, you know, I don't know if they're faking it or not, but my God, you know, if we knew about all this, why is it not in the annual intelligence briefing that is given to both the House and to the Senate early each year? It's missing. All we get is, you know, all we get is rhetoric about how bad the Russians are, just as if they were the old Soviet Union, ideologically determined to bury us.
Do you believe, Ray, the claims that none of those missiles were shot down, or the claims that three-quarters of them were shot down? Who do you believe?
It's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of evidence.
Indeed.
We have people on the scene, okay? And we know that of the 105 or 103 missiles shot down, three-quarters of them, I mean, shot toward Syria, three-quarters of them were shot down.
Who
we know that.
Who's evidence?
Well, some of us veteran intelligence professionals to sanity come out of a military environment with the respect of people on the ground. Those people on the ground are not reluctant to let us know what's going on, despite all the rhetoric coming out of Washington. One curious thing. Yesterday, Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov was having an interview. And he's saying, you know, it's really hard to know who is in charge in Washington, because when the president is described as calling up somebody, he says, did all our missiles make it? And the answer is, yes, sir, they sure did.
Well, you know, that's not the way it works in Russia. In Russia, the chief of the armed services calls Mr. Putin and lets him know on a minute-by-minute basis what's going on. So who is this guy? Who is this fellow that reassured Trump? I all meet him. Well, my guess, and it's a pretty good guess, I think, was the same John Bolton, who is appropriately described as crazy.
But the people that you rely on, do they have any photographs, any video, anything I can see?
Yeah, they do. But David, you'll understand that they are not in a position to actually share that stuff. What I can tell you is that this is the same evidence that we had to show that other false flags, particularly the one at Khan Shaykhun in Idlib province of Syria last year on the 4th of April, was a hoax. So I can tell you that these people are monitoring these things minute by minute, and that they have the sense, the integrity to say, well, you know, this is not right. They would be lying about all this. 105 missiles did not make it all the way. 71, I think, is the figure that sticks in my mind, were shot down.
Yeah. Speaking of Lavrov, Ray McGovern, he's been claiming in recent days that the supposed evidence of this chemical weapons attack in London was sent to a lab in Switzerland that showed that, in fact, it couldn't have come from Russia. It must have come from the United Kingdom or the United States. But it seems the Russian foreign minister is the only person who's seen this evidence. Has anyone else seen it? What's your assessment of that chemical weapons claim?
Well, David, I didn't see that in the New York Times, and so it can't be true. I, Josh, of course. But this is as bad as it is. Now, that is an independent, well-respected outfit in Switzerland that analyze those things. That whole poisoning in London was the epitome of what in the Bronx we call a crock. You know, it was a sham sort of thing. And even to their credit, the scientists and engineers upon whom the government in London depends. The folks that manned the Porton Down biological chemical laboratory, they were unwilling to support what Theresa May and Boris Johnson had already said, namely that Russia, we know it was Russia. Well, what did Porton Down do? They got a sample of this thing, and they said, well, you can't say it was from Russia. I said, what do you mean we can't say it's from Russia? And they said, well, you can't say that because we can't verify that. All we can say is that it was of a sort, of a type, that was developed by Russia, but we never were able to prove that Russia made any of it. What we do know is that 20 other countries can make it. It can be made in a university laboratory. So, no, we can't say it was from Russia. So if you watched the early renditions of British statements, they backed off, and they always said it was, quote, of a type developed by Russia, end
right.
quote, because that's all the experts would let them do. And Craig Murray, the ambassador that we are in touch with, who's part of our group, who has really good contacts with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and also with Porton Down scientists, finished off one of his blogs to me, and he said, look, he said, Ray, I think now listen carefully for the irony, I think I might now have a vodka of a type developed by Russia, but made in Warrington, a lovely little town. So, you know, it's of a type. Now,
right.
it's really terrible, really awful. But, you know, the British do this all the time. They did it with the dodgy dossier before Iraq. And, you know, I recall my grandfather telling me, Raymond, do you know Do you know why the sun never sets on the British Empire? And I said, yeah, I know. You don't know. Now sit down and I'll tell you. He says, the sun never sets on the British Empire because the good Lord would never trust the British in the dark.
He would be right in that. The other thing I noticed, Ray, in President Putin's concerns among the lunacies that are afloat here, is he's afraid of cyber attacks being treated as war. So not just chemical attack murders in London and other justifications for war, but something that happens on somebody's computer and you get bombed for having started a war. And I heard Senator Tim Kaine here at the University of Virginia last week tell me that acts of cyber war, including Russia's having stolen a U.S. election, are at the level, we can't say exactly what level it should be, but they far exceed it to count as war. Meaning that in the view of Senator Kaine, the United States ought to be now at actual war with Russia because Russia started a war with the United States.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, because we have so little time left, that the Russian hack is a hoax. There is no proof of a Russian hack. Matter of fact, we, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, a group that includes two former technical directors of the National Security Agency, have forensic evidence to prove that there was no Russian hack on the celebrated day on which we have metadata. Okay, so that's number one. It's very distressing that a formerly intelligent person like Tim Kaine.
When was that? When was that?
Well, yeah, I remember when he was governor. He wasn't so bad. He was a little better than what the others are standing with.
That's a low bar, Virginia governor standard. Okay.
Well, okay. So what he's saying is what John McCain said right away. He said, this is an act of war. What did John Bolton say? It is a true act of war. And what happened? The head of the FBI deliberately avoided seizing the computers of the Democratic National Committee to see how it was that the Russians intruded and perpetrated this act of war. It was a hoax. It was rubbish. There is no proof that the Russians hacked. And the business about WikiLeaks, well, WikiLeaks only puts out documentary evidence. And so they're really angry at WikiLeaks because of the release of those Democratic National Committee emails 3 days before the convention in 2016, Democratic National Convention, which showed without any doubt that Hillary and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and that whole crew had tilted the primaries and the rest of the preparation for the Democratic National Convention in such a way that Bernie had no chance to win it. Now, that's the real bottom line there. So if you're going to blame anyone, to blame anyone for Donald Trump, and I hold no brief for Donald Trump, I believe he's the worst president we ever had, okay? But if you're going to blame anybody for him, if you can blame Hillary Clinton for the way she fooled around and tilted the nomination so that she would win it instead of Bernie Sanders, I am morally certain that had that not happened, we would have Senator Bernie Sanders as president right now. That is one big deal, and it's all provable by looking at the way the election came out. And who to blame for that? Well, it couldn't possibly be a candidate who nobody trusted or didn't campaign in the right states. No, it had to be something else, and Russians were the ones that took the blame. So the whole thing is so strange, and to see people like Tim Kaine not only buying this stuff, but also promoting legislation that would give the president even more even more leeway to start wars. I don't know what's going on. There must be something in the water here in Washington.
Well, he credits the Miller Center here at the University of Virginia for having written every word of his and John McCain's proposal to strip away the War Powers Act.
That would be no surprise to me. I believe it or not, the Miller Center has never asked me to come down and talk to them.
They've never asked anyone to speak about peace ever. War, plenty of times. With just a few minutes left, I among the 18 some odd parties I would blame for Donald Trump, in addition to Hillary Clinton and the DNC, would be the corporate media and the incredibly disproportionate coverage it gave to him, with CEO of CBS saying he may be bad for the country, but he's good for our ratings. And yet, as you already mentioned, the so-called independent media, Democracy Now! Included, seems to be dropping the ball. Not only that they don't create their own stories, they just do the other stories a little bit better, but Democracy Now! Has been having on all these people in recent days who want to overthrow the government of Syria, which I should have thought, you know, the corporate media could more than handle that perspective. What's going on with the media, and what do we need to do about it?
Well, David, I have to start out with a little song.
Okay.
Once in love with Amy, not always in love with Amy. I tell you, you know, it's one of my major disappointments. I have to say that her coverage of national events is outstanding, okay? But the coverage, of, especially since Hillary lost, okay? Her coverage of foreign affairs is terrible. I mean, she's giving the white helmets, for God's sake, the PR outfit that works for Al-Qaeda and al-Nusra, she's giving them plaudits, okay? Giving them credibility. And she doesn't let any of us on. I haven't been on there a couple of years. And, you know, I think what I describe as the virus that came into New York and Washington right after the election in 2016, it's the HWHW virus, and that stands for Hillary would have won, okay?
Yeah.
Now, okay, what does that mean? That was PTSD. Everyone knew that Hillary's going to win. These people have not recovered. Now, I can understand, especially women and people in my own family, they hate Trump, and there's good reason for their hatred. Look at the way he treats women. I mean, I can understand that. Probably not feel it as deeply, but I can understand it. But my God, you know, can't they see how this whole manufactured excuse, namely it was the Russians. Well, we'll see in the next days. And because documents have been provided from the FBI and from the Department of Justice to the House Intelligence Committee, we'll see what was really going on there in terms of using Russia to blacken Trump. It didn't work, and so they're doubly angry about how it all came out.
We will be watching, and we will hope to have you back on in the future. Ray McGovern, his website is raymcgovern.com. Check it out. Ray, thank you very much again for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You're most welcome, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as we record the show on May 10th, the FCC has posted notice that net neutrality rules will disappear on June 11th. That should come as a surprise to all of the media that told you that net neutrality already died on April 23rd. So what's going on? And since abandoning the fight for an open internet is not an option, what do we do now? We'll talk with Tim Carr of the group Free Press. Also on the show, in the Columbia Journalism Review last September, journalist Mary Annette Pember wrote about the value of reporting that represents Native Americans as whole people, with all their frailties and glories, far beyond the 3D paradigm, a reference to the quip from Wildo Wapipa, former Metro editor at the Oregonian, that when Indians appear in the newspaper, they're usually dead, drunk, or dancing. Pember was writing about what looked like the end of Indian Country Today, a major source of news on and for Native communities. But Indian Country Today is back, launching under the auspices of the National Congress of American Indians. We'll hear from its editor, veteran journalist Mark Trahant. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin. All social justice fights intersect in some way, but net neutrality is the definition of a keystone issue. The policy protects the space in which to discuss and debate and organize all the other fights, the means to talk around the legacy media gatekeepers, the ones who tell you that killing people in other countries to force them to change their elected leadership is reasonable, but providing health care for everyone is outrageous. In a sort of slow-motion train wreck, the Trump FCC, led by former Verizon lawyer Ajit Pai, moved to dismantle net neutrality protections only recently won. Millions of people voiced their strong opposition, but were overruled, while Pai and his agency produced a truly bizarre video of him doing a smug victory dance to show off to a bunch of industry lobbyists. But reports of the death of net neutrality, which listeners will have heard last month, might be exaggerated. In fact, the fight, too important to give up in any event, is still underway. Here to bring us up to speed is Tim Carr. He's Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. He joins us now by phone from Hoboken. Welcome back to Counterspin, Tim Carr.
Hi, Janine.
These events, we want to be clear, are evolving as we speak. We're recording this show on May 10th. Lots of listeners will have seen red alert banners across the web yesterday designed to draw attention to the fight. And then just now as I was eating lunch, I read that the FCC has now declared the official death of net neutrality will be June 11th. What is the current state of play here?
Well, it's easy for people to get confused about the various ins and outs of the net neutrality fight. It's a battle that we've been fighting for 13 years now. We did win, as you mentioned, a huge victory in 2015 when we got the Federal Communications Commission to put strong net neutrality rules in place. And those were then rolled back under the Trump FCC and their chairman, Ajit Pai, in December of 2017, voted to repeal those net neutrality rules. And because of the administrative process in Washington, it actually takes some time for that vote to take effect. It also triggered something else, and it's something that we've been working on, and it's why people have seen those red alerts around the web. There is a somewhat arcane congressional process under the Congressional Review Act that allows Congress to reject a rule change. And we have been pressuring members of both chambers, the Senate and the House, to sign on to what's called a resolution of disapproval that would reject Ajit Pai's ruling and restore the net neutrality protections that we won in 2015. It's a bit of a race against the clock because we have to get that resolution passed within 60 legislative days of the vote. So we have a couple of weeks left. And the good news is that the Senate plans to vote on the resolution of disapproval sometime by the middle of next week, around May 16th or 17th. And that would be one step along the way to restoring net neutrality protections. The other thing that you mentioned is that the rule change actually goes in effect on June 11th. So what we're doing is really focusing on the congressional piece, getting the rule itself reversed. But my organization, Free Press, is also very active in the courts. We are suing the FCC, saying that the decision that Chairman Pai made didn't follow a correct process. It was based on false information. So we also have the courts, the Federal Appeals Court, where we're bringing a suit against the FCC to restore the net neutrality protections as well.
Well, and another thing, just to add to that, that seems to be going on is that, you know, as soon as the Trump FCC did this, and it was widely predicted, I mean, you saw it coming up the avenue as soon as, you know, Pai was made commissioner. Some states said, well, we can try to preserve net neutrality rules at the state level. Can that work? It sounds a little counterintuitive.
In the absence of net neutrality protections at the federal level, a lot of local leaders have stepped in. And we've had more than 30 states introduce legislation that would restore net neutrality protections statewide. Washington State, for example, has passed net neutrality protections. There's a law that's very close to being passed in California and other states. And also, state governors have stepped in to sign executive orders. There are six states where the governors have signed executive orders that prohibit the state from doing business with any internet provider, these phone and cable companies like Comcast and AT&T, that violates net neutrality. And in addition to that, more than 100 mayors have also signed onto a pledge that said that their city will not do business with any ISP that violates net neutrality. So that we're talking about billions and billions of dollars of business contracts that are at stake here. So local leaders have stepped up as well. They're responding not only to the outrage of the decision that was made at the FCC last year, but also responding to their constituents. And the poll after poll after poll shows that it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent or any other party, overwhelming majorities of people in the United States support net neutrality rules. We're really pushing back against this very concerted effort inside the Beltway, which has been funded by the phone and cable lobby, to take away these rules against what most Americans say they want, which is these protections for the open internet.
Well, that's what makes it so dystopian. You know, the FCC in name is meant to be the representative of the public, you know, in the telecommunications industry. You have millions of people, you have states, you have communities saying we want this, and then you have the FCC saying, you know, too bad. You know, it seems really bizarre.
Right. This is not the way our democracy is supposed to work, right? You know, the people that we have in Washington nominally are supposed to represent the people who put them in office, which is why we're confident that not only, you know, this is an effective issue around which to organize the public and to get them involved in Congress, but we also have a sound legal argument to show that Chairman Pai was really defying the law itself, the 1996 Communications Act, by making this rule change.
Well, I'm looking through media coverage, and as I'm reading USA Today, I come across this headline. It was a link to a kind of explainer that they had, and it said, "Net neutrality rules are dead. Will my internet bills go up?" And, you know, I think we can all appreciate consumer-focused reporting. And, you know, thinking about cost is, generally speaking, a progressive approach. But in this case, I couldn't help but see it as a really significant misrepresentation of what's at stake here, which is not just a matter of your bills going up.
Yes, I mean, what we've often called net neutrality, the First Amendment of the internet. And by that, we mean that it's a rule that prevents your internet service provider from blocking or interfering or throttling with your internet connection. When you pay whatever it is you pay to AT&T, Comcast, or Verizon to provide you with an internet connection, they complete that contract and then they get out of the way. which is to say you go online and you are in control of your own media experience. You get to choose which websites you go to, which services, online services you use, and your internet service provider simply connects you to those and provides you with the speed of service that you've purchased. What they're trying to do is get paid at both ends. They're trying to make you pay for access, but also to go to the various websites and services out there and say, hey, do you want to reach our customers? You have to pay us extra. And they can privilege certain websites. In the absence of net neutrality rules, they can privilege certain websites and services. So, for example, Comcast, which has its own video streaming service, could make that work over your connection, and they can hobble a service like Netflix. But I think the point that you're getting to really is about the importance of the internet, not only for that sort of those sorts of business relationships and having customers control that experience, but also as a tool for organizing some of the most important protest movements of the last decade, whether you're talking about Black Lives Matter, whether you're talking about March for Our Lives, the Women's March, of all of these important movements have been organized over an open internet, where the groups and individuals who organize these political movements can go online with the assurances that their access provider won't in any way prohibit their ability to make those connections, to connect with people, and to organize very large movements out of their, you know, their bedroom office or their garage or their, you know, wherever it is that they're doing this work.
Right. We know that, you know, with corporate media, if you can't find an advertiser to sponsor your message, well, your message doesn't get on, you know. And that, of course, is the beauty and the power of a free internet, is that you can get points of view out there that a deep-pocketed corporation doesn't want to sponsor, but that we as a society nevertheless want to hear and want to discuss. Well, I understand also, though, from work by Ernesto Falcone at Electronic Frontier Foundation, that ISP lobbyists are going around the states now, because as we've discussed, states are working on their own net neutrality stuff. ISP lobbyists are going around to states now saying that net neutrality is going to put them out of business. You know, that if they can't do paid prioritization, well, they're not going to have the money to pay for upgrades, and they're going to have to charge more, which brings us back to that USA Today piece, will my internet bills go up?
Yeah, well, these are companies that make tens of billions of dollars annually in gross profits, so they're not going to the poorhouse.
Right.
All we're asking simply is that they observe some simple rules of the road, and they preserve the democratic principle that makes the internet so important for internet users.
Finally, you want swells of public attention, you know, particularly if there's a time window for communicating with lawmakers, for example. But as much as we want to gin up attention in some strategic moments, we have to see this as a long-haul battle, don't we?
We do, and I think, you know, it's really important that this battle, even though we've had some wins and we've had some losses, has really been successful in mobilizing public support. And there are now tens of millions of people who've taken action on this issue. And we're looking at the possibility later this year that the composition of Congress could change and that we would have a different set of leaders there who support net neutrality. There is hope not only in the short term with the upcoming elections, but over the long term, should a new administration come in to restore whatever net neutralities we may have lost. And so for us, it really is a movement building exercise. It's about getting as many people as possible to understand what's at stake and to throw their support behind protecting the open internet, and also to understand that they have agency, that they can take action, they can call their members of Congress, they can write the FCC, and there are organizations like ours that are standing behind them and will make sure that their voices are heard.
We've been speaking with Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. They're online at freepress.net. Listeners also might want to check out battleforthenet.com. Tim Carr, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
After campus police at Colorado State University pulled two Native American teens off a college tour when a woman told 911 they were definitely not supposed to be there, the school's president spoke directly to concern about white supremacists and their attempt to frighten and isolate people. While if headlines are meant to tell the tale, the New York Times' Native American brothers pulled from campus tour after nervous parent calls police fell rather short. Euphemism aside, listeners likely heard about the incident, spotlighted, like others, via social media. Did you know, though, that fully a third of the senior Interior Department officials reassigned in Secretary Ryan Zinke's recent reshuffle are Native American, even though Native Americans make up less than 10% of the department's workforce? Sources say it's part of Zinke's barely veiled plan to remove obstructions to extractive industry. That news, reported by Alice Olstein at Talking Points Memo, and that's about it, is also a story about indigenous people and their life in 2018 America. Isolated snapshots of outrageous harms are a meager substitute for genuine coverage of a complex community. There are plenty of things that won't be captured on cell phone cameras. Our next guest is dedicated to engaging the wide range of issues affecting Native Americans. Mark Trahant is a veteran journalist and journalism professor, former president of the Native American Journalists Association. He blogs at TrahantReports.com, and now he's editor of the new Indian Country Today. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mark Trahant.
Thank you. Always good to be here.
Well, there's such an informational and narrative void in U.S. media around Native communities and issues with particular impact for them, with the understanding that not all 560-some tribes or the people within them have the same issues, of course. But how is Indian Country Today looking to place itself in the landscape? Tell us what the project is as you see it.
I think it's, first of all, solid journalism, letting people know what's going on a daily basis and putting in perspective so many of the challenges we all face. I think if you look at the media landscape, the one thing that's so often missing when reporting about Indian Country is what I call the narrative of excellence, where we have so many remarkable stories about people doing extraordinary things, and they're never told. And so most of the country, all of they do see is just the problem side. They see the challenges. They never see these moments that really speak to what the country could be as well as what Indian Country could be.
Yes. For example, May 5th was just National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. And one wants that crisis to be illuminated very much, you know, but crisis and hardship is never going to be the whole story of a community. And when it comes to minority communities, we just know from experience that that narrative of failure, as I believe you've referred to it, it doesn't necessarily lead to the kind of interventions that we might be seeking, you know, in the first place. But community media has this famous bind where you want to counter the pathological representations of the community. At the same time, you want to present a complex view, which is critical when it's appropriate. But then folks say, well, how can you be critical of us? You know, we're getting killed out there. It's a delicate in some ways role.
Well, in fact, in 1828, the very first editor of a tribal newspaper was Elias Boudinot, and he faced probably the most difficult question ever when the Georgia Guard was trying to push the Cherokee Nation out of Georgia violently, and tribal leaders said, we shouldn't talk about some of these issues because it's going to make it worse, and he argued, no, information will make us stronger, and that debate has gone on in Indian Country, as in most communities, really ever since. Where do you draw the line in terms of protecting a community versus truth and good, solid information? And of course, being the journalist, I come down on that side of the question.
Absolutely. Yeah, I see it actually mostly in the labor community, you know. But as you say, the day-to-day stories and with Native communities, a lot of those have to do with government, with policy, but they get lost. And I know that one policy area that you have been tracking in particular is healthcare, the shifts in Medicaid, the work requirements, and the deeper changes lurking in that for Native Americans, and then the Indian Health Service itself is its own another story. I wonder if I could draw you out a bit on some of the underexplored aspects of healthcare for Native communities.
Sure, and it's a really great example from both fronts. First of all, when the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act was passed in 1974, the average age of death for an American Indian or Alaska Native was in the 40s. And it should be one of the most remarkable stories told, is how a dedicated healthcare system has improved the lives of Native Americans. And yet most people write about it in terms of the gap that continues to exist, which is there. And you certainly can write about it. But if you look backwards even 50 years, you think, wow, look how far people have come. Mm-hmm. This is a really remarkable improvement. The same thing is Medicaid. It used to be that the Indian Health Service was by far the biggest funder of health programs on reservations. And even today, that's shifted where, and when I first started reporting, in fact, about Indian Health, I thought it was like the one I grew up with, where you went in and saw a government doctor and kind of that treatment plan. And starting in about 1975 up until now, tribes have been saying, you know what, we can do this better. And now 60% of the Indian health system is run by tribes or nonprofit organizations, not the federal government. The federal government role is actually shrinking. The other thing is, in that same time frame, Medicaid has become the primary funder of Indian health. And even more people are still eligible for Medicaid than are in the rolls, so there's still an opportunity for growth. And the great thing about that, for from a patient's point of view, is if you go into the Indian Health Service in the old days and they were out of money, unless you had a life-threatening disease, there was nothing that could be done. Now if you go in, no matter when you go in, and you're eligible for Medicaid, the money is there and your health care follows. To me, and I hear it a lot with, let's create Medicare for all, and I'm, no, Medicaid is much better than Medicare, but it doesn't get as good press.
Well, and the shift to requiring potentially these work requirements, it seems as though the Trump administration is using that opportunity to do some redefining there. Is that true?
There is, I think, a division of philosophical ideas about healthcare. One side sees healthcare as something that is separate and a right and something that ought to be served. And steps like Medicare and state programs and tribal programs are methods to get us there. The other side, frankly, sees Medicaid as welfare. And so they start throwing these other things into it that have nothing to do with healthcare. There's no way to improve somebody's life to make them go look for work when they're trying to get healthy. It costs more. It doesn't improve the system. There's a new study out in Alaska where some of the folks might be in places where there's just not a lot of seasonal jobs, or they might be doing jobs where they feed their family with hunting and fishing. There's other ways of being in an economy, and that doesn't get reflected in Medicaid and a work program. It really is not a very efficient way to do healthcare. It's much better to say, let's get people healthy and do what we need and then figure out these other economic measures.
And are they saying also that they are not, well, it's race-based, you know, it's not, they're kind of trying to change even the way that Native communities are understood.
Right. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare have recently signed on with these state waivers, basically saying that they're race-based and therefore illegal. And that really flies in the face of entire constitutional history, where Native Americans are the only people mentioned in the Constitution, and it gives Congress a plenary right to do these kind of programs. So it really turns its head on most of the country's history. And the reason for that is the founders of the United States recognized that tribes were governments, and that idea has really gone through the history of the Republic, where tribes were treated as governments that were here first, and as such treat their citizens in certain fashion.
Well, when we spoke to you back in September of 2015, the New York Times, in a story about Barack Obama approving the renaming of Mount McKinley to Denali, as Alaska Natives had always called it, the paper called that an effort to improve relations between the federal government and the nation's Native American tribes, an important political constituency that has a long history of grievances against the government. Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but I'm not sure how much the Trump administration or the major media, frankly, see indigenous people as an important political constituency. But for those that do, what's the story there that we might not know about electoral participation?
Well, first on the big issue, I just don't think you can understand this country's history without understanding how tribal communities fit into the story. It's so essential part of how the country came to be and continues to be and how it's shaped. On the electoral side, I think this is really an exciting year, and I've written a lot about this. First of all, there's more Native American women running for office. There's more Native Americans running for state legislatures. Congress has hit a record for people going that route. Recently, for this TV show I'm working on, I decided to walk from the steps of the Capitol and walked just under 11,000 steps, and that's to represent the 11,000 men and women who've been elected. By the way, one-third of all the women who've ever been elected to Congress are in office now. And in that time, with nearly 11,000 members, not a single Native American woman in the history of the entire country. And this time around, there are four really potential candidates to change that.
That's really interesting, and it sounds certainly newsworthy. We're certainly seeing a lot of coverage of the election, and that fits right in. Well, finally, you wrote of Standing Rock and that battle. This is a fight about story and who gets to tell it. So I want to bring you back to Indian Country today, because we know from inside of journalism and outside, we know that brave storytelling, part of it is having an institution behind you to back you up, to do that storytelling. And I know that you have some personal knowledge there. But what is it? What's most exciting? What do you think folks should look for in Indian Country today? And what are the challenges that you know you're up against?
Well, the big opportunity is we're trying to refashion it as public media. So we'd have to do fundraising and all of that sort of thing, and eager to get out into the public. And I actually think that's a good thing. I think the idea of relying on advertising and subscriptions is really limited. And this allows us to still do some advertising, but it really broadens participation by people, and I think that's really important. So one of the ways we'll do that is all of the things we produce for Indian Country today will be available for other media for absolutely free. And that's keeping with that public media mission of getting the word out and trying to do that. We'll also provide a platform for upcoming Native American journalists, both younger ones and ones who've been around a while. And we'll do that with a combination of fellowships and other ways to kind of support that. I think the idea of storytelling is just essential, and really recognizing there are so many talented people out there that could be telling great stories to the country if they had the platform, and we hope to be that platform.
We've been speaking with Mark Trahant, editor of Indian Country Today. Look for them online at IndianCountryToday.com. Mark Trahant, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosado. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
Weather has become destabilized around the world as we approach the 1.5 degree C global average warming. 30,000 experts, policy people, and diplomats are in Poland planning for the next round of international climate talks. They are pushed by a wave of new science warning 2 degrees is too far beyond safe. Talk of desperate measures to cool planet Earth is coming out of the closet. A series of new papers, assessments of risk, and the way forward were just released by the Royal Society in Britain. We'll talk with the lead editor, Dan Mitchell. Then it's environmental lawyer Robert Verchik asking, who pays for the warming made by the West when it wrecks countries far away from this fossil-powered miracle of modern civilization? How much is a country worth when it sinks forever below the seas? Where will millions and millions of climate refugees go? It's talk at the highest levels right here on Radio EcoShock. C Scientists like James Hansen have warned the Paris safe limit of 2 degrees C is not safe at all. The Royal Society just published 20 scientific papers investigating the differences between 1.5 degree warming and 2 degrees. They find that extra half degree could have extreme consequences on everything from the economy to weather. To prevent that last half degree warming, the project also includes studies of low emissions grids, carbon capture and storage, and even solar geoengineering, blocking the sun. The editor for this project is Dr. Dan Mitchell from the School of Geographical Sciences at the University of Bristol, UK. Dan is also the coordinator for the HAPPI project, H-A-P-P-I, which stands for Half a Degree Additional Warming, Prognosis, and Projected Impacts. Considering the Paris Climate Accord still accepts a limit of 2 degrees C warming with 1.5 as an option, the difference is information we all need to know before it is too late. Dan Mitchell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, nice to be here.
So, Dan, why does a mere half degree of warming warrant so much work from so many scientists?
Well, as scientists, we often look towards our politicians for the questions that they're really keen for us to address, because these might have large impacts on, say, a country's economy or the way it operates. So most of the time, we just deal with questions that we find scientifically interesting. This particular question on half a degree additional warming for us is very interesting, because not only is it scientifically important, but our politicians are also asking us this question. So those two things together have meant that we were sort of very keen to look into the problem.
As I mentioned, Dr. James Hansen, formerly chief scientist at NASA, criticized the Paris Accord, warning 2 degrees of warming is not safe and not a viable goal for humanity. In general, Dan, what does this new group of studies say about that?
Well, you know, I think we have to be slightly careful when we say sort of 2 degrees is not safe. Previous to the Paris Agreement, there'd been very little work done on what 2 degrees would do to the climate system, and even less work on what 1.5 degrees would do. Most of our previous work was looking at sort of 3, 4, 5 degrees of globally average warming. So it's hard to sort of jump to those statements without doing the thorough analysis. So I guess our papers have showed that 2 degrees, we can detect the climate change impact on human systems. So for instance, health systems through extreme heat waves, or agricultural systems through changes in flooding and things like that. So yes, we have detected a climate change signal, which is detrimental at 2 degrees. But likewise, any climate change can be detrimental. So even at 1.5 degrees, we still see some problems with the climate system. The key point here is the less we can warm the planet, the better off we'll be.
It's a bit confusing to me how the Paris Climate Accord came out with two numbers, 1.5 or 2. Can you tell us sort of how that developed?
Yes. So often these numbers used are more political than scientifically based. You know, there's nothing magic which happens at 2 degrees, which doesn't happen at 1.9 degrees, say. They're just sort of convenient numbers where we expect we can avoid a lot of the impacts of climate change. So they're sort of rounded to the nearest half a degree, say. The 1.5 degree number was quite specific because it does retain to a lot of island flooding. So low-lying small island states may well lose a lot of their coastal lands between 1.5 and 2 degrees, which is why they were pushing in particular to get this 1.5 degree limit in the Paris Agreement, so that they could sort of, you know, make some statements about how their islands would be sort of beneficial for that.
Dan, who called for and funded this large project you worked on the impacts of that last half degree of warming, as published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society?
Well, there were a number of different funders who funded the papers within the Royal Society issue. the papers I was involved with were funded by a UK research council called NERC, that's the Natural Environment Research Council. But different lead authors from around the world would have been funded through different organizations.
But was there a particular body that called for this study or organized it?
This particular set of papers, we as scientists decided to do it in conjunction with the Royal Society in the UK. But we did it because of the IPCC special report, which is coming out. And the IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So they are sort of the largest climate change body in the world. And they put these sort of regular reports together. So our special issue is sort of to help inform on that report.
I know that scientists don't want to be alarmists, that there's a caution built into scientists. But I have to say, I've interviewed many, and our climate situation looks alarming to me, and so are some of the paper titles in this new series talking about, for example, uncertainty, urgency, and the last gamble possible. Is it really serious what we're talking about?
Well, the main problem with climate change is, and specifically with carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas that we talk about, is that once it's in the atmosphere, it's very hard for it to go away. So carbon dioxide can stay in the atmosphere for thousands of years, which means sort of if we're not quite sure, you know, what a certain impact of increased temperatures will be, it's much safer just to decide not to put carbon dioxide in there, because then we don't have to wait for a thousand years to sort of see what our mistake might be. There are alternatives. We can take carbon directly out of the atmosphere, but we can't do that on a scale which makes any sense for the climate change problem, both politically or economically.
In a recent Radio EcoShock program, we heard from Chandra Bhushan. He's from the Center for Science and Environment in Delhi. He said that they have calculated for 9 months of the year, India is already at the 1.5-degree warming mark, and over 2 degrees for 2 months last year. Considering that more heat is still hidden by global dimming, I'm wondering, is it already too late to aim for 1.5 degrees of warming?
I don't think it's too late. I mean, with India in regard, India has been warming a lot more than many other regions in the globe. And the land surface has definitely been warming more than the oceans. So it's not surprising that we have these regions of, say, India, which have been higher than 1.5 degrees, certainly in the very high northern latitudes, for instance, over the Arctic, but also in certain parts of Africa, they've also warmed more than 1.5 degrees. But that's a very different question to the globe warming more than 1.5 degrees, because that's a huge amount of warming that needs to go on, you consider the size of the globe. It doesn't surprise me that these regions have warmed more. I don't think that really has much of a bearing on if we can achieve the actual Paris goals.
Good. Well, suppose, though, that we reach a warming of 1.5 degrees C over pre-industrial levels at a global mean, and maybe some crops fail and drought or extreme weather become too costly for our economies. If it becomes obvious that 2 degrees is untenable, what would be the remaining options as considered in these new papers?
The most likely option, and the one that most scientists would favor, would be to do something called carbon capture and storage. So that is directly taking out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and storing it somewhere else. The problem is that costs money, so we have to decide who pays for that. And in that sense, we might introduce something like a carbon tax. And all a carbon tax is a tax levied on the carbon contents of fuels. So that just means if you're going to burn X cubic meters of carbon-emitting fuel, you'd have to pay a certain amount of money. And then we can use that money to invest in technologies to take the carbon out of the atmosphere. So that could be one way. A more controversial way, of course, is talking about these geoengineering strategies. And by geoengineering, I mean changing the atmosphere in some way to cool the Earth's surface. Now, there's very few scientists who actually advocate for doing this, but there are scientists who advocate for research into this as a very last resort. And so two of the papers in our special issue talk about the ethical implications of that and what the sort of climate consequences might be of that.
Okay, now one of those papers is titled Solar Geoengineering as Part of an Overall Strategy for Meeting the 1.5 Degree C Paris Target. The lead author is Douglas G. McMartin from Cornell and Caltech. What sort of technology is envisioned here?
Well, there's a number of technologies that they talk about in that particular paper. The main one they're proposing is something called stratospheric sulfate aerosol injection. Now, to sort of break that down as to what it means, all it means is that they would put in very fine particles up in the stratosphere layer of the atmosphere. So the stratosphere is about 10 kilometers high and extends to about 50 kilometers high. And it's well known to the sort of public as the region where we have the ozone layer, for instance. But when we have huge volcanic eruptions, dust from those eruptions and sulfate aerosol from those eruptions travel up to the stratosphere and they get trapped up there. And what we see during those huge volcanic eruptions is that the dust reflects incoming sunlight. And therefore, we don't get as much sunlight at the surface. So it cools the surface of our planet. And that's essentially all these geoengineering methods are saying, is we would mimic a large volcanic eruption by putting these aerosols into the stratosphere, thereby stopping so much solar energy getting to the surface. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, if we're currently in a 1 degree world, so our current climate is 1 degree warmer than pre-industrial levels. If we were to say go to a 2 degree world, and then we geoengineered back down to a 1 degree world, we wouldn't get exactly the same climate as we get now, and that's because the Earth system is very complex. And that's the real issue with geoengineering, is that it's not entirely obvious that if we geoengineered to the same temperature, we'd actually get the same climate. That's where the research is in that particular paper.
Right, and the main concern voiced by many is that solar geoengineering may have unexpected consequences by altering cloud formation and or precipitation. What do the authors of this paper say about that?
Well, the authors of this paper and the other geoengineering paper sort of say this is, you know, by far the largest concern of their papers, and this is why they're not advocating for doing geoengineering. One of the papers does propose that if we were to do it, you'd do it in a very small amount to start with, and you would just see what happened. But you'd have to test this over sort of decades and then look at things like the impact of the aerosol falling out of the stratosphere, for instance, on precipitation.
Radio EcoShock.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. Can the world afford to reach 2 degrees of warming as agreed at the Paris Climate Summit? Not according to a series of new papers published by the prestigious Royal Society. We're speaking to a leader in that big project, Dr. Dan Mitchell from the University of Bristol. Dan, please talk to us about some of the large impacts expected in a world 2 degrees warmer, the level accepted by world leaders signing that Paris Accord just about 2 years ago.
So the impacts on the Earth system are very varied. So for instance, for storms in the North Atlantic, it's hard to see too much of a change in those sort of things, the 2 degree world. For hurricanes in the Atlantic, for instance, it's hard to see change in, where those hurricanes will go. But globally, changes in hurricane frequency may come about at 2 degrees. And so we may get more Category 4 and 5 hurricanes, not necessarily in the Atlantic basin, but sort of in various basins around the world averaged together. In terms of extreme weather, there's quite a clear signal in heat waves and cold snaps. That's increased number of heat waves and decreased number of cold snaps. But things like the precipitation response, so flooding and droughts, that's a lot more varied, and it's a lot harder to tell the responses around the world for those. Certain regions, like the Middle East, it's quite a clear signal that they will get hotter and drier, which is, of course, particularly important for that region where there's a lot of sort of stressed tensions anyway. So the picture is not looking great.
Well, what about one of your interests, Dan, the health impacts of a warming world?
Yeah, so climate change and health is sort of quite strongly linked on a number of ways. My work is focused a lot on the extreme heat and the extreme cold, and there's a very clear signal in both of those that if the population of the world stayed the same, we would see increased heat-related deaths and decreased cold-related deaths. However, the population of the world's not going to stay the same. It's going to increase. More people are going to move into cities. Cities retain heat. So there's going to be an even stronger signal there. There'll be certainly a higher proportion of our population will be the elderly generation, as we sort of more able to care for the elderly. And therefore, we're going to see sort of very strong changes in the number of deaths in the future, which is something we need to sort of prepare for. Outside of the sort of extreme heat and cold, there are other health concerns with the Paris Agreement. Changes in vector-borne diseases such as malaria and dengue fever. Though it's less clear that the climate change problem is really going to be an issue because there are such good medical interventions at the moment, so anti-malarials and the like. So we concentrate a lot on the sort of extreme heat side of things, but there are other issues, and I don't have time to go into all of them, but disease from flooding, for instance, is another sort of issue.
Right. It's a huge subject on its own. And I know on another topic that you were awarded an independent research fellowship by the UK's Natural Environment Research Council to, quote, study the link between the stratosphere and extreme weather at the surface. That's a fascinating topic. And three questions come to my mind. And the first is, can climate change or greenhouse gas emissions or any other human factor change the stratosphere?
Yes, that's a really good question, actually. They do change the stratosphere. In fact, greenhouse gases in carbon dioxide in particular changes the stratosphere in a fascinating way, and it's much stronger than the change we see at the surface. So at the surface, we've seen about 1 degree of warming so far. In the stratosphere, the change is nearly an order of magnitude larger, so 10 degrees. The interesting thing about the stratosphere is that instead of globally average warming, we actually get globally average cooling. And that's exactly what we expect from the theory of climate change. So this was actually even predicted before we observed climate change. We predicted that carbon dioxide would have to warm the troposphere and cool the stratosphere. And that's one of our sort of strongest bits of evidence for human-induced climate change, is that actually we get that really strong dipole pattern. So there is a very strong climate change signal in the stratosphere, but to sort of extend on that with your second part of your question, does that matter for the surface? Well, it's a very active area of research, and it looks as if that climate change signal is not translating into anything too major for the surface. It's more to do with the natural variability of the stratosphere, which can cause some particularly extreme weather, especially for Europe and Northern America and Canada.
Is that related to the polar vortex?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, so the polar vortex, I guess it's more well known to the general public as the sort of region where we have the ozone hole. So we have a polar vortex in the northern and the southern hemisphere. And it turns out that the ozone hole is much bigger in the southern hemisphere, although there is an ozone hole in the northern hemisphere. But this polar vortex can be disturbed, so it can get broken down from time to time. And so actually only a month ago, here in Europe, we experienced some very cold weather, a lot of snow, and that was because the polar vortex broke down and it changed the circulation down in the troposphere. So it's those sort of extreme cold weather events which are really important. And you often see a very strong link between Canada, especially sort of Hudson Bay area, and Europe when these things happen.
Can you describe a couple of other papers in the study series that you think our listeners should really know about?
In terms of the Royal Society issue?
Yes.
So one of the interesting questions is, if you're a government, you have to make a decision if it's going to cost us X trillion of dollars to prevent half a degree of warming, but it's only going to cause half of that cost in impact damages. Should you really stabilize climate at the lower limit? Because it's going to cost a lot more. Now, there's one paper which deals with the economics of climate change. It's the Prater et al. Paper, and that discusses some of those issues in detail. So that's an important one to look at. Another important one comes out of our colleagues from the institute called ETH, and they look at the impact of the land surface on globally average temperature. So most of the papers look at how changing carbon dioxide can increase global warming to half a degree. Their paper looks at how if you just change the land type, so if you went from a forested area to a non-forested area, how big a globally average temperature can you get? And they find that you can get half a degree globally average temperature just from changing the land surface type, not changing their greenhouse gases at all. So that's, another important implication.
So, Dan Mitchell, we have this assessment now that 2 degrees of warming may not be tenable and the Paris Agreement may need some changes. So what happens now? Is there a next step where this science can get turned into international public policy?
Well, that's the real challenge in the IPCC report that I mentioned, which is the sort of large intergovernmental report, will give some recommendations as to how dangerous 2 degrees is compared to 1.5 degrees. I think it's a little bit early to say that, you know, at 2 degrees we're doomed and at 1.5 degrees we're not. That's not what our report's saying, and I'm pretty sure that's not what the IPCC report will say. What we need to do is weigh up the balances of the change in probability of detrimental impacts at 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees, weigh up the economic costs, the social costs, and then sort of make a decision there as to how best to proceed.
And what about at the national level? We know that America has officially turned away from climate action at the federal level. Are European governments looking at 1.5 degrees as the real goal, and what does the UK say?
Yeah, exactly. Europe is doing, in the UK, is sort of leading the way and really pushing for 1.5 degrees. Yes, the US government did sort of do an about turn on that subject, but actually, especially over in Europe, we've been really impressed with the state level US response. Certain U.S. states saying, actually, we're going to really sort of try and help out with this Paris Agreement. So that's been really nice to see. Other countries like India, for instance, have, since the U.S. have pulled out, they've really sort of stepped up and said, you know, we're going to really go above and beyond our bit to fight this problem. So countries are really banding together, and that was one of the sort of great achievements of the Paris Agreement. It's just how many people did come together.
But the hole in the plan is covered in the last paper in this series by Robert Verchik, where he says, quote, even assuming a heroic rush towards carbon reduction and adaptation, some regions of the world will be hammered hard by climate impacts, and there's supposed to be a loss and damage plan to help compensate those who get hit by climate but didn't really cause it and don't have the resources to deal with it. But I think this is where scientists and economists and the rest of us worry the whole thing's going to fall through and that we're not really going to help the other people who need it.
Yeah, I mean, there's big concerns there, and you summed it up nicely. But you know, what they're saying is there are countries, certainly in Africa as well as elsewhere, where there's going to be very strong impacts of climate change. East Africa, the Horn of Africa, is a natural example. Places like Somalia, in Kenya, and Ethiopia, And it is very unfair that these were not the people who caused climate change. It was the developed world. We had our industrial revolutions, and, you know, the UK is more to blame than most for that. And now we're sort of asking these other countries not to have their own industrial revolutions because it's going to harm the atmosphere. So there needs to be something put in place to say, okay, you need to be compensated for the fact that you can't have the same technological push as our countries did. And you also need to be compensated for the fact that we've caused this climate change and you're the one feeling the consequences. They're very, very tricky negotiations, as I'm sure you can imagine. And that's a very active area of research where I think we'll see more and more papers coming out. But certain countries like Bangladesh are really leading the way there. They set up a really nice loss and damage fund, which is used as a sort of preventative measure more than a compensation measure, in the sense that they use it to help forecast early warning for, say, crop failure, and then they can use that fund to help farmers change their crops or help them get the information they need to plant it at a different time. So that's where that sort of funding will be very useful.
We have been discussing a round of 20 scientific papers published by the Royal Society. They are in a special May 2018 theme issue titled The Paris Agreement, Understanding the Physical and Social Challenges for a Warming World of 1.5 degrees C above pre-industrial levels. The papers are open text. They're available free to the public. You can take a look for yourself. We've been speaking with the editor and author of the introduction paper, Dr. Dan Mitchell from the University of Bristol, UK. He is also coordinator of the HAPI Project, Half a Degree Additional Warming, Prognosis and Projected Impacts. You can find links to all of this in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Dan Mitchell, thank you so much for helping us out on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. It was nice talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When extreme storms, fires, or crop failures devastate the poorest people in the world, will anybody save them? The richest countries polluted the atmosphere with climate-changing gases. Who will pay how much, for what, and how? Since hardly anyone in public media is talking about this, we will. A series of papers published by the Royal Society in early April 2018 showed the 2-degree guardrail for global warming is not safe at all. The project ends with a research article titled, Can Loss and Damage Carry the Load? The author is Robert Verchik. He is the Gauthier St. Martin Chair in Environmental Law at Loyola University in New Orleans. But Dr. Verchik is on loan to Yale as a visiting professor to the Yale Law School. Professor Verchik, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks.
You begin your article for the Royal Society with these words, I quote, "Even assuming a heroic rush towards carbon reduction and adaptation, some regions of the world will be hammered hard by climate impacts." So, Rob, when world leaders know climate change is now unavoidable, what is the forum where these issues of climate equity are being discussed?
They're being discussed with the UN at the UN Framework for Climate Change. And currently, this involves countries that are all signatories of the Paris Agreement and that are all members of the Convention Framework on Climate Change. The U.S. is a member of the convention framework, but as you know, the Trump administration has announced that it would like the United States to withdraw from the Paris Agreement.
To get further with this discussion, we need to know how you define the term loss and damage.
Sure. Loss and damage is a phrase that was developed by the international community under the climate change convention. And it is a phrase that basically refers to what I will call the leftover risk of catastrophe that occurs after we have reduced greenhouse gases as much as we can And after we have helped countries adapt to storms and temperatures and so on. So if I could say it this way, there are three categories we might think of. One is a category of greenhouse gas reduction, and that is about avoiding climate impacts that we can't manage. Then there's a category called adaptation, which is about managing impacts that are inevitable, that is, impacts that we can't avoid. And now we are starting to realize that we are going to have climate change impacts that, A, we cannot avoid, and that, B, we will not be able to manage. And those kinds of catastrophic impacts are described by this phrase in the international community that's known as loss and damage. It's basically the leftover losses and damage after you've tried to reduce greenhouse gases and after you've tried to adapt and cope with them.
Should we call people who lose their homes, crops, or even their island nations victims? Is there a better term than that?
Well, that itself is up to a lot of debate. So it is true that many people who are going to be very catastrophically affected, particularly in island nations or in developing countries, these are people who are at very high risk and whose countries have done proportionately little in many cases to have contributed to the problem. So in the sense that they are being hurt by climate change, losing their property, sometimes their livelihoods, and being exposed to health risk, you can certainly say that they're victims. They're victims of other countries that have built their economies and increased their wealth by emitting greenhouse gases and then leaving it to others who can't afford it to essentially shoulder the burden.
I just wish there was another word for it, though. However, has any money been set aside already to compensate victims of climate change? And if so, how much?
Well, money has been set aside through the international processes with the UN to be transferred in many cases to developing countries. The purpose of that money is slightly different than compensation. So, for instance, through the Paris Agreement, for instance, richer countries promised to provide $100 billion by 2020 as a minimum amount of money that would then be transferred to developing countries. And this money would be used to reduce greenhouse gases, that is, that they would be used to modernize electric grids, to develop no-carbon sources of electricity. Some of that money is also designed to help countries adapt, which means, let's say, building seawalls or improving city plans so that residential areas don't get flooded, that sort of thing. The richer countries, that is, the developed world, the industrialized world, has so far backed away from any talk of what they call the C word, compensation, because that implies that the industrial world did something wrong and that it owes something to the rest of the world that it's harming. And those are legal terms that so far the United States, the European Union, and other parts of the developed world, they have avoided that kind of a discussion. The poorer countries very much want a discussion about compensation, and they see this as a right, that is, as a right to be made whole from decisions that were destructive, that were made by others.
I'd like to discuss some of the five possible tools you raise in your article, and the first is insurance. What does climate insurance look like?
Well, climate insurance in some ways is like any other kind of insurance that's based on the variability of weather or other sorts of climate-related effects. I think that in the international community, what we're talking about are things like regimes for crop insurance that would prevent or at least make farmers whole after there had been, let's say, a devastating drought or some kind of blight on crops. It could also be a kind of weather insurance where a country could, for instance, take out a policy in which it would be compensated a certain amount of money if there were a certain storm of a certain size that came to the city in a given year. You know, it would be a kind of thing like that. So it could be weather-related, it could be crop-related, flood-related, anything like that. There's a problem, though, with insurance markets and climate change. And the problem is that in a world without climate change, insurers over the years have been able to essentially figure out how much risk that they can take on in any given year because they use the past years as a reference. And so if you look at enough past years, you can say, well, there will be, you know, there's this chance of a storm, there's this chance of a flood, there's this chance of a heat wave. With climate change, all bets are off because we can't use past events to tell us about what we can expect in the future. And so it's possible that insurance companies won't be able to adequately price, if you will, the risk in the future. And it's also possible that if you're talking about a drought and climate change where the temperatures rise, you know, let's say 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, you could have situations where you have multiple droughts in a single season throughout the world. And if that's the case, the insurers might go broke. They might have too many payouts in a given year, and that would lead to a fracturing of the system.
Oh, well, it might go bankrupt.
That's right.
Yeah. So another tool for after-the-fact climate compensation, if you want to call it that, might be relocation assistance. What is envisioned there?
We are at the very beginning of talking about relocation and different kinds of climate migration. And we don't even know how big this issue is. I mean, we could be talking about, you know, tens of millions of people moving. And there are a few ways that we might imagine that would happen. You might think of it in terms of immediate displacement after a terrible storm, and we see that, for instance, let's say right after Puerto Rico, where there was the giant hurricane, and almost immediately Puerto Ricans began moving to the mainland of the United States, some temporarily, some may be there permanently, and it just sort of happened suddenly. There are other kinds of moves that we call migration, which explains people gradually moving from some areas into others. And so you have widely expanding deserts in North Africa, for instance, and people just gradually moving from those areas into cities or to areas where there's more water. And then relocation is where an actual community or a town might actually pick up and say, we want to organize ourselves and completely move. The problem with this is we expect, as I say, millions of people over the next several, you know, decades will be moving in some way, in part because of changes in climate. But these folks will not have, under international law, what we would normally call refugee status, right? That is, in order to have a status as a refugee in the world under international law, you have to show that you are fleeing some kind of political persecution, essentially. There's no form of refugee status for fleeing environmental problems or economic problems. And so these folks will have no status, right, as refugees, and yet some of them will be moving literally because their former countries are inhabitable. You know, if you think of residents of small island nations who are literally seeing their territory swallowed up. You could imagine people who no longer have citizenship because their country no longer physically exists. So you would start to have problems where people, A, don't have citizenship anywhere or anywhere to go. We are desperately in need of some kind of a global international program that would recognize this kind of status. And we don't yet have it. What we have now are countries that are in discussions with one another on a very sort of small basis. So we have, you know, for instance, Australia is in discussion with some countries and some island nations in Southeast Asia, you know, or Pacific Island countries, you know, thinking about, well, maybe we'll have an increase of or a liberalization of immigration status in some way. But it's really not fair to ask only the Australians or only the New Zealanders, let's say, to accommodate all of the people in the Pacific. They couldn't do it, and they're not the only ones responsible. We're all responsible. You know, those of us in countries that have profited quite a bit from fossil fuel consumption over the years.
And that would certainly include the United States and Europe, and yet in the political climate of Donald Trump and the reaction in Europe to an early wave of migrants from whatever cause, it seems like climate immigration is just such a hot-button issue.
Well, that's right. And you know, although it's not a subject of the paper that we're discussing, I've done other research showing that we are in the midst of climate relocations right in the United States. In fact, there are somewhere between 12 and 15 communities in the United States that are actively looking to relocate because their areas are becoming unlivable because of climate impacts. These communities actually are all tribal communities in the United States. There's one in Louisiana on an island that's sinking slowly. There are several up in Alaska, these coastal communities whose shorelines are literally falling in because of thawing permafrost. And there are a few communities on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State that are also trying to find ways to move because their land is slipping into the ocean.
You can help Radio EcoShock keep going. Make a donation at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Robert Verchik. He's an expert in international environmental law. And we're talking about who will pay what when the climate goes seriously wrong. Robert, for the layperson, what is the Warsaw International Mechanism on Loss and Damage, and how does that fit into this discussion?
Well, there was a discussion a few years back about what would happen if we had catastrophic events from climate impacts that we couldn't avoid. And the developed countries, the industrialized countries, believed that the best way to handle, you know, let's say a catastrophic storm that might occur in Indonesia, let's say, they thought that the best way to handle that would be the way that we normally handle aid from hurricanes or from other natural disasters, which means that it's a kind of aid that the global community gives in a sort of charitable way without the legal framework of a climate convention. The small island nations and many other developing countries felt that they wanted some kind of program that was going to be better funded and that would hold richer countries accountable for having caused the problem. And they referred to this issue as loss and damage, that is, loss and damage resulting from catastrophic effects of climate change in the developing world that could not be avoided. And so they insisted that some kind of transfer of wealth be connected to what they called loss and damage within the Framework Convention on Climate Change. There was a meeting in Warsaw. There's a meeting every year among the parties of this climate convention. And in Warsaw, everyone agreed to say that we would do something to address this form of catastrophic loss and damage. But we couldn't agree on exactly how to do it. The poorer countries wanted loss and damage to include a compensation package, which would literally compensate countries that were harmed by, let's say, a mega storm, and that they would get money or other technology or aid from the richer countries. The richer countries didn't want to promise compensation. They wanted this to be more of a transfer of money and technology in order to help countries build, let's say, better seawalls or stronger buildings. But they didn't want to get into a discussion of paying for damage that had already occurred that they might be seen as liable for. And so we are left right now in that debate. The Paris Agreement actually mentions the term loss and damage, and that's a win for the developing world because the developing world fought hard for loss and damage to be something that would be addressed in the Paris Agreement. But nobody has agreed on exactly what that aid, what that transfer of wealth and technology is going to look like. The industrialized countries see this as maybe helping the developing world with insurance. The developing world is hoping that this program turns into some kind of a larger shift of finances in response to compensation for actually, you know, causing a problem. They believe that under international law, the richer countries are harming the poorer countries. And under international law, if you do something that hurts somebody else's country or causes somebody else extreme damage, you have to pay for it.
We just heard from an expert that the mean average temperature in India has already breached the 1.5 degree warming mark for 9 months of the year. And the Arctic is far, far above that safety line. James Hansen says there's another 1 degree at least hidden by air pollution. I just feel the whole Paris Agreement and the UNFCCC process is far too conservative. Am I off base?
I think that that is a real concern. The answer is we don't know how much climate change we're going to be seeing, you know, in the next 50 years. The Paris Agreement commits us to keeping that increase, as you know, to 2 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial levels, and commits us to working toward getting to a limit of 1.5. But many scientists are already saying that we are not going to make a 1.5 limit and that we would be lucky to make the 2.0 limit. I mean, that's a problem. I mean, you know, if you look at how long it takes to design these agreements, and the Paris Agreement, of course, was many years in the making. It's like, you know, I tell my students, it's like you're designing a bridge, you know, and your supervisor says, design a bridge that will hold the weight of 50 cars at once. And then the next day, your supervisor says, no, make that 100 cars. And then the next day, the supervisor says, no, make that 1,000 cars. At some point, you just have to look at your design and say, well, I'm going to go right back to the drawing board and start anew. We don't want to have to start anew with the Paris Agreement. And that, I think, is why it is so important that we try everything we can to keep our greenhouse gas emissions down. We have the technology to do it. We actually have the money to do it, but we don't have the political will. And it, the point of my paper and the other papers in this journal, the point is that if we don't keep these numbers down, the carbon emissions down, we're going to have to go back to the drawing board again, and we're not going to be able to come up with anything that's going to be remotely satisfying. You know, we are stuck, and we have to do the hard work because there really isn't, you know, an alternative plan at this point.
And your paper does acknowledge that the future may be worse, and so it's hard to plan. And the second principle you put forward for handling that is not very obvious. You say, do not cannibalize resources. What do you mean by that?
The international community, the industrialized world, is already providing money for its own transition to green energy. And as I mentioned earlier, the industrialized world is already making financial transfers to the developing world in order to promote more green energy and to cope with climate impacts. When I say don't cannibalize, what I mean is now it also seems clear that the developing world, the global south as we call it, is going to need money and resources to help with relocation and migration and insurance and these other things that we've been talking about that are related to loss and damage. And we shouldn't say that as we in the global north, oh, well, we'll just take some of the money we were going to give you you know, for the green energy transition and we'll just make it, you know, turn it into money for loss and damage. You can't just take money out of one fund and then put it in the other fund. You're actually going to have to increase the entire pie. That is something, of course, that is politically difficult for any country in the global north to do. But the reality is it is going to have to be done because it's either pay now or pay later. There is simply no way we're going to avoid the kinds of mass migrations that will be coming. There's no way that we're going to avoid the loss of wheat production, let's say, in Central Africa. That is going to happen. And there is no way that a country like the United States is not going to be affected by that when there are millions of people crossing borders or there are famines in foreign countries. It is not like those things don't affect us. They will affect us because those things will cause violence in some countries. They might lead to civil wars. They're going to lead to security issues all over the world. And so the only real decision that we have to make in a country like the United States is, are we going to, in an orderly and planned fashion, try to respond to those issues before they happen, or are we going to wait for all of that stuff to happen and then try to respond on the fly? It's just going to cost us more money and more security and more, you know, more confusion, all of those things. It's just going to be harder for us to respond to those issues without planning. So my message in my article and in my other research is that, you know, we have to understand that these are problems. They're really, really big and serious problems, but the only way to address them is to face them, because not facing them only makes everything much, much harder to do in the future.
So if a more realistic climate reparation system is established, who will administer the large amounts of money and who will oversee that system to reduce corruption?
Well, that's a really good question. Under the current convention framework, the UN has a few what they call facilities, that is, you know, sort of a few offices that manage the development funds right now, the climate funds. So it could be managed in that way, or it could be managed through aid that moves through the World Bank or through the International Monetary Fund, or you could see this happening from national banks of some kind, you know, whether it's the National Bank of Germany or USAID and the State Department here in the United States. You could imagine sort of a global clearinghouse system, which we've already got with through the UN, and you could also imagine sort of multi-party programs or even bilateral programs from one country to another.
What are the next steps?
Well, I think the next steps are going to involve the Paris Agreement. Right now, we have a system where each country that's a member of the Paris Agreement has submitted its own nationally determined commitments for what it will do in the next few years to address climate change. And those commitments are both commitments in terms of reducing greenhouse gases and commitments in terms of adapting their cities, their buildings, in ways that can cope with climate change. We entered a new kind of an experiment with the Paris Agreement because every country is allowed to come up with its own goals and to come up with its own commitments. And so some countries are much more aggressive on their commitments than others. But the hope is that if we put that kind of flexibility in the system, that everybody will do something. And so the next step is to see how these commitments are implemented. Every country is required to submit under the Paris Agreement, to submit their goals, and then they're required to submit information about how they are progressing. And based on that, countries will then decide, you know, how much they'll commit in the future. And countries in the developing world will, I hope, see the implementation as a way of showing that they are acting in responsible ways and might be able to get, funding and transfers of technical assistance from other countries. So we're going to have to see. I mean, there are some big questions there, especially because the United States has stated that it plans on leaving the agreement, which would leave the United States without very much leverage at all in terms of what the next steps would look like. I will say, though, that there is a glimmer of hope in all of this, and the glimmer of hope has to do with how quickly the price of green energy technology has fallen over the last few years. Wind energy, for instance, is almost on par, and in some places on par with generating electricity through coal. And so regardless of what happens in international environmental law, we are going to see a move toward a greener and greener economy. We are going to see a move toward zero carbon electricity generation all over the world. And we've got major banks in the world that are, you know, including the major national bank in Germany, national banks in China, and also the World Bank, which are saying that when they make loans, that they want to look at the whole carbon cycle of the projects that they lend money for, because they understand that there is a cost to generating the carbon, you know, carbon emissions, and that that's going to affect the value of the projects that they lend on. So there are going to be a number of things happening within the markets themselves that will end up tamping down on carbon emissions. No question about that. The only question is it going to happen fast enough? You know, when the Trump administration, you know, starts throwing sticks into the spokes of the wheels, it stops things and delays things. It doesn't mean the progress won't happen, but it slows it down. It's a dead-ender strategy, but delay is an important villain in this piece, and we have to go as fast as we can.
We have been talking with environmental law professor Robert R. M. Verchik. He's currently visiting the Yale Law School while on leave from his post as the Gauthier St. Martin Chair in Environmental Law at Loyola University in New Orleans. Dr. Verchik just published his article, Can Loss and Damage Carry the Load?, as the concluding paper in a series in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. You can read Robert's full article for free, and I'll put the links you need in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Well, obviously, that discussion could go on for another couple of hours. It's a deep, deep subject. I would like to ask you at some point, how you see the role of the legal profession and lawyers now that climate scientists have kind of wrapped up the case, so to speak. Maybe we could talk about that another time.
I'd love to.
Robert Verchik, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Next week, we'll hear how fracking for gas killed the safe way out. And Rob Hopkins, the co-founder of the Transition Town movement, makes a personal transition. Be sure to join in for the next global broadcast of Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Israeli security officials at the airport have outsourced to these right-wing Zionist, unreliable, lying, troll websites the job of sorting who's a security risk and who isn't.
It's clearer that we were targeted because of the company we keep rather than the work that we do.
The academic boycott in particular, I think, is very powerful because I think the movement emerged at a time when academics were beginning to get slightly fed up of the censorship.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Coming up next, an in-depth interview with Sunaina Mehra, author of the book Boycott, The Academy and Justice for Palestine. Stay tuned.
Do you ever miss back home? I meet some people, but they perfect places.
Prepare for takeoff, touchdown, Ben Gurion. Strict search, make sure nobody enter with bombs. Blue, white flag for this birthright, Toramon. Never mention three villages that the airport is on. Recent history buried, but it speaks through the sand. All Jews, law of return, I don't seem to understand. A land without a people, for people without a land. But I see a man standing with a key and a deed in his hand. Museum of the Holocaust, walking outside in the distance. All goes throwing a Molotov, houses burn with kerosene. Mass graves, couldn't bear the scene. It wasn't a pogrom, it was the ruins of Deir Yassin. Shopping at the Kenyon Malha, built it on the back of the town Al Malha. Wishing we could call its name, appalled by the change. And now a marvel of chains is all that remains. My aim of missing people, not places. Actually seen the town with names of Arabic, the Hebrew places. The policies of evil and racist, the secret and heinous. You'll never see a people stable, legal displacement.
مش تعلم حلات اللي ولا مرة شفتها. مش تعلم وجوه اللي ولا مرة قابلتها. مش تعلم محلات ولا مرة شفتها. مش تعلم وجوه اللي ولا مرة قابلتها. مش تعلم محلات ولا مرة شفتها. مش تعلم وجوه اللي ولا مرة قابلتها. حياتي زي صغري بمطار إسرائيلي. يعني ولا مرة راح تشوف لي بظهري. ومع إني واحد بيعمل ريكا خمسة. بيدين يحوني فبيستنوني على الدخل. فجأة المطار طار وصار مطار تل أبيب. مع إنه موجود أراضي اللين. وفاري بأراضيها ولاقي مناضي اللين. فوت على دورها ولاقي ياسمين. أسامي شوارعها هرتل تاهل مش صلاح الدين. وخان الهيلو صار مر خراب المدمنين. سطات دمش تغطي جرح اللي بسيل الدم. لهود لود كمان مشروع اللي بسم الغن. وهي مش الأولى ولا الأخيرة. ما احنا احنا البحر وهي السفينة. بتشتف باتجاه شباب يسارها ويمينها. وهيك الهولي لاند بتبطل هيلاند. مش تعلم محلات اللي ولا مرة شفتها. مش تعلم وجوه اللي ولا مرة قابلتها. مش تعلم محلات اللي ولا مرة شفتها. مش تعلم وجوه اللي ولا مرة قابلتها. مش تعلم محلات اللي ولا مرة شفتها. مش تعلم وجوه اللي ولا مرة قابلتها.
Trees uprooted the groves to build a wall, not in future enclosed. Sediment spreading like cancer and toxic sewage polluted the roads. Not full of checkpoints that superimpose the truth and it shows. Village ruins overgrown with planted trees. Who'd have thought the desert blooms a tuber spot? I can't believe it ain't environmental. Disguising lies, extincting lives like manatees. Calling it a transfer, please. More like a catastrophe. Birthright towards recruiting them, confuse them into moving in. Claim it's only names and words, but denying the root of them. Power been abusing it. I pass never excusing them. 60 since 48 and 40 since Jerusalem. My boy Shaddy wanted to visit us so badly. He lied he's diabetic to see it for 5 seconds. 194 ruled the courts in the case. Mom, you can't disconnect the people from the importance of place. My aim of misses people, not places. Has you seen the towns with names in Arabic, the Hebrew places?
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and this is the Electronic Intifada Podcast. I'm here in Oakland with scholar and author Sunaina Mehra. She is a professor of Asian American Studies at UC Davis and is on the organizing collective for the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, U.S. ACBI. She's also a founding member. Sunaina is also the author of the new book, Boycott, The Academy and Justice for Palestine, published by the University of California Press. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Sunaina, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada Podcast.
I'm thrilled. Thank you, Nora.
So the book is a well-researched, elegantly structured documentation of the academic boycott as part of the larger boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign called by Palestinian civil society. You zero in on the boycott movement within U.S. academia, how it began, its role in challenging the dominant Israel-centered narrative, and how scholars are fighting against what you call the archive of repression that we can get into later, which is the incessant, unrelenting backlash by those who wish to keep the dominant Zionist narrative dominant. Let's begin by having you lay out what the academic boycott is in relation to the broader BDS campaign and how it's helping to steadily shift that narrative.
Sure, yeah. So the academic boycott was called for by Palestinian intellectuals and scholars in 2004, so a year before the larger call for BDS was issued from Palestine. And it calls on the international community to boycott Israeli academic institutions until Israel complies with the three principles of BDS. And as with the BDS movement at large, those principles are ending the occupation and colonization of Arab lands occupied in 1967, respecting the rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality, and respecting the right of return of refugees. And I think these are significant because, you know, it really has been decades since these very basic human rights principles were even discussed in the U.S. university. And so the academic boycott movement was, you know, was an opportunity for U.S. academics to end the complicity of the U.S. university with Israel until it complies with these basic principles of human rights. And I just want to add that it's really important to note that this was meant to be a boycott of Israeli institutions, so not of individual Israeli academics or Jewish Israeli scholars or Jewish American scholars, as, you know, the opponents of the boycott have sometimes alleged.
You write about the ways in which Israel is presented in mainstream academia and how even presenting the Palestinian narrative is instantly seen as controversial. How did this position on Israel become so mainstreamed in the university and really the only acceptable position to have?
That's a very good point. It's actually normative. It has been normative for many years. The only acceptable and kind of legitimate and civil position, if you will, is to actually support Israel and to refrain from any criticism of the Israeli state. And I think, you know, that status quo has been maintained the same way that the status quo in general discourse in the U.S. has been maintained, you know, due on the one hand to the power of the Zionist lobby. So, you know, the university is actually very susceptible to interventions by off-campus pro-Israel groups. And so I think by now, you know, there's this whole, you know, archive we have of documentation of the ways in which, you know, Zionist organizations have pressured university administrators to, you know, fire or censor, you know, academics who are doing work on their campuses that might be deemed critical of Israel, to discipline students. So I think it's the force of what the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, IJAN, calls the Zionist Backlash Network, you know, this web of organizations that constantly intervenes in academic freedom. That's one thing. On the other side, I think, is the vulnerability of U.S. academics to censure and defamation. And so, you know, academics as a class, I think, are very vulnerable or feel they're very vulnerable to any kind of public criticism or defamation. And because I think, you know, on this particular issue in the larger sphere, you know, in the U.S., there also is not a lot of sympathy to an honest account of Palestine-Israel. It means academics really have tended to toe the line. So when I entered the academy, by the way, you know, about 15 years ago, and I started teaching, you know, I remember people saying, you know, don't touch the P word, don't utter the word Palestine in your classroom. And so I think that, you know, as the U.S. university has also become increasingly reliant on adjunct labor, and tenure track positions are really difficult to get, and tenure is hard, you know, to attain. I think that this makes, you know, this kind of censorship and lockdown of Palestine-Israel a kind of baton that people can wield over U.S. academics because they feel insecure academically.
I really appreciated reading about how you analyzed the propaganda war to protect Israel's image, both by the Israeli government itself, but also by its civilian front here in the U.S. and abroad. Stephen Salaita, the author, academic, and contributor to the Electronic Intifada, who is the notorious subject of a campaign by Israel-aligned forces to oust him from academia because of his outspoken criticism of Israel and Zionism. Steve says, and you quote him in your book, that groups such as the Anti-Defamation League have used the language of liberal humanism and tolerance, civil rights, and anti-racism to promote and consolidate that support for Israel as a prerequisite of responsible multicultural citizenship, which is nowhere more evident than in the academy. Can you talk about how Israel and its supporters have really weaponized this language and how the academic boycott works to challenge it?
Right. I think that's a very important point. And, you know, Stephen unfortunately knows too well how that has been weaponized and used to kind of really deepen the situation of academic insecurity. But I think the point that he makes in that quote in the book is actually really important, because what he was sort of trying to point out is that, you know, it's actually support for Israel, a foreign state, not the U.S. state, by the way, that has actually become a core element of responsible multicultural citizenship in the United States. And so if you are critical of Israel, you're deemed anti-Semitic, therefore you are racist, and therefore you're not a good multicultural citizen. And so on college campuses where the discourse of multiculturalism is so prevalent, I think the ways in which supporters of Israel, I like the way you know, sort of pointed out that it's a civilian front, you know, of Israel, because, you know, they get funding from the Israeli government. The ways in which supporters of Israel have actually managed to consolidate that embargo on criticism of Israel is by making criticism of Israel you know, outside the pale of, you know, proper university behavior and protocols. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there has been legislation that Title VI legislation that has actually made, you know, criticism of Israel anti-Semitic in college campuses. And so, you know, they've used lawfare on the one hand to try to basically, you know, penalize universities that are deemed to somehow foster, you know, the so-called anti-Semitic critique of Israel. That hasn't worked, but I think what has worked is actually a kind of cultural, you know, hegemony in which, you know, criticism of Israel is just not permissible. So it's what I talked about earlier. It's people telling other people or whispering to other people, just don't do that event, just don't bring that speaker. And so I think it's that kind of, you know, sort of just cultural understanding that this is something that one should just not engage in because, as you said, it's considered too controversial, that has made that the norm. And then I think on the other hand, I just want to also note that we also do know that the U.S. is a special ally of Israel. So this support is also coming from the state. And I think that that is also very powerful, that in other issues, one can be openly critical of China or, you know, Sudan or, you know, other states without necessarily worrying about the extent of, you know, punitive backlash.
And how does the boycott campaign address that?
Right. I mean, and I think that was the second part of your question, which is really key. So I think the way in which the boycott has challenged that lockdown is by, you know, creating awareness and discussion about Palestine and Israel. And I think because it is a tool, it's not exactly a movement that, you know, people can sort of deploy in different contexts. It's allowed students to organize divestment campaigns and to mobilize student bodies to actually, you know, confront what's really happening in Palestine. The academic boycott in particular, I think, is very powerful because I think the movement emerged at a time when academics were beginning to get slightly fed up of the censorship. You know, I mean, academics are intellectuals. Not all of them are Zionists, actually. And so I think people were just getting kind of fatigued, you know, that there was, you know, this constant silencing and, you know, harassment. And so I think the academic boycott allowed academic associations to take a position. And I think I talk in the book a little bit about why I think this is a war of position, because I think it's about shifting the parameters of cultural discourse and, you know, intellectual discourse. And so, you know, when the ASA, the American Studies Association, endorsed an academic boycott resolution in 2013, it became clear that, you know, critical scholars were actually deeply concerned about Palestine. And so it really shattered the taboo on criticism of Israel by creating a space for discussion.
We're here with Sunaina Mehra. She is a professor at UC Davis and also the author of Boycott, The Academy and Justice for Palestine. You mentioned the war of position, and that's a theory by the great late Italian communist writer Antonio Gramsci, the war of position versus the war of maneuver. Can you talk a little bit about that more and how you bring that in to talk about the context of BDS as a tactic and a tool?
Right. So in fact, one of the things that I say in the book is that, you know, the war of position is the struggle to challenge dominant cultural beliefs in contrast to the war of maneuver or open war and armed attack. And it's been key to understanding the successes of the boycott as a social movement that has challenged the hegemony of Israel. So as we've been, you know, discussing, that has been based on a set of popular beliefs that normalize the policies of Israel. And so I think the ways in which I see the BDS movement reflecting on it, you know, over the last 10 years now is that I think what it has been instrumental in is doing is through these kind of small incremental steps, really challenging the normalization of this kind of Israeli exceptionalism in the U.S. And so I think in that regard, it's very important because, you know, Israel itself is very concerned with this war of position. So it's very apparent. I mean, they themselves talk about the fact that, you know, they're deeply worried about what they call delegitimization of Israel. And so there's a war of legitimacy. And I think it's very important to note in this regard, by the way, that this is not about the existence of the Israeli state, okay? I mean, because there's all this kind of really melodramatic, you know, kind of allegations that BDS is out to destroy the state of Israel. But I think if we think about the three principles of BDS, it's fair to say that they point out the fundamental flaws in the notion of Israel as a self-professed democratic state that, you know, affords equality to its citizens. And so in that regard, I think, you know, BDS has provided a discourse that now people can pick up and use to challenge that exceptionalization of Israel as being above critique. And so going back to the point about multiculturalism, I think one of the things that Israel has also tried to do through its Brand Israel campaign is to kind of present the image of being multicultural and cool and gay friendly and, I don't know, women friendly and worker friendly and African friendly and all of these things, which are not true. And so I think, again, the BDS movement, I think, has provided, you know, kind of ordinary people with a language that they can use to basically, you know, rupture this kind of myth.
As you said, and as you write, the role of BDS is providing that language. And it's a textbook example of a social justice movement like any other, but has received a minuscule fraction of the recognition and research. And here's where the scholarship on BDS and the Palestinian liberation struggle overlaps with the fight against neoliberalism in the U.S. academy, increasing privatization and the censorship of academic research or basic activism on campus, as you said. Can you talk about the role of BDS, a little bit more about how we can talk about BDS as a central player, you know, in terms of elevating the Palestinian liberation struggle as just another social justice movement?
I mean, for many people, that's an oxymoron, like thinking about Palestinian liberation as being a social justice issue. And, you know, in your book, Nora, on the student movement and, you know, BDS activism, I think you noted, in fact, that, you know, BDS activism has become the kind of social justice, one of the fastest growing social justice movements on college campuses. And that really struck me because I think, you know, that really indicates the kind of 180 degree shift that has happened, you know, in many campuses where, you know, we see that people have completely reframed, you know, the issue of Palestinian rights or Palestinian liberation. And so I think in that regard, you know, to me, what is really kind of important is that on the one hand, you see masses of students taking up the cause, you know, of Palestine and getting engaged in BDS and bringing it into social justice activism. So there have been so many alliances that have been made between, you know, Palestinian, you know, rights campaigns and Students for Justice in Palestine organizing and campaigns against the militarization of campuses, policing, police brutality, Black Lives Matter, also thinking about, you know, issues around, you know, walls and immigration and refugees, as well as, you know, these questions around, you know, kind of apartheid and racial equality. And academic freedom. And I think all of those have helped to transform BDS into a social justice issue. But, you know, fundamentally, it has to be acknowledged that, you know, BDS is a framework that was provided by Palestinians. And I think that, you know, there are two points to be noted. One is that, you know, it wasn't always like this, that I think in the United States in the 60s and the 70s, there was a moment when, in fact, radical activists were in solidarity with the Palestinian liberation struggle, and that leftists and anti-war activists actually were critical openly of Israel. And so I think in a way the BDS movement has allowed campus activism to return to that internationalist framework of third world solidarity, which has been, you know, diminished somewhat in the last decades, or even when it emerged, you know, for example, challenging the war in Iraq. I mean, there was just never a connection made to Palestine. And then the second point, you know, I would say is that I do think that Israel's own excesses have fueled some of this, you know, outrage and sympathy with Palestinians. And because of social media, I mean, the work you do, for example, in Electronic Intifada and other outlets, it's harder for people not to know what's going on. And so I think that for, you know, both of those reasons and other factors, probably, I think it has become more of a social justice issues. So, you know, when I first started getting involved in the Palestine movement, you know, about like, you know, 17 or 18 years ago, I mean, you know, people used to call it PEP, you know, Progressive Except on Palestine. And I felt like Palestine activists were so marginalized and it was so frustrating. And we felt so isolated and constantly under siege in the community, you know, not just on campuses. And, you know, I think that that shift, so that I think we're getting to the point where I think we're almost there where to be progressive, you do have to stand with Palestine, I think is pretty remarkable.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present independent investigative journalist and author Gareth Porter, who assesses the dangerous consequences that could result from President Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the International Iran Nuclear Agreement. Neela Banerjee of Inside Climate News, who discusses Trump Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt's actions that are rapidly turning over EPA decisions to industry priorities instead of the public interest. And Palestinian-American businessman and entrepreneur Faisal Saleh, who explains why he opened the first Palestinian museum in the U.S., relating the story of a displaced people. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Myanmar, Yang Hee Lee, is calling for an end to the escalation of violence in that Southeast Asia nation's northern border of Kachin State, home to decades of ethnic conflict. While global attention has focused on the atrocities committed against the Rohingya Muslim minority in Rakhine State, fighting has resumed along the border with China and India in Myanmar's Kachin State. The Guardian newspaper reports that humanitarian relief supplies were blocked from reaching Kachin's internal refugees in April by Myanmar's military, which used aerial bombing and artillery fire targeting civilian areas. Over 100,000 people have fled to camps for the displaced in Shan and Kachin states since a government-endorsed ceasefire crumbled in 2011. About 5,000 people protested in the capital of Kachin State on April 30th, demanding that the government rescue displaced civilians trapped in fighting between Myanmar's army and the Kachin Independence Army, an ethnic rebel group. On April 25th, more than 30 Kachin civil society organizations urged the UN Security Council to refer the Myanmar military to the International Criminal Court for what they say are human rights violations against civilians and the denial of humanitarian assistance to people in need in Kachin State. British Petroleum's 2010 Deepwater Horizon explosion killed 11 oil rig workers and spewed millions of barrels of crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico. That disaster provoked concern for worker and environmental safety, leading to the creation of the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, which is now at risk under the pro-fossil fuel Trump administration. The Bureau, staffed by 130 inspectors, has struggled to inspect 2,000 fossil fuel extraction projects from the Gulf of Mexico to the Alaska coast. The agency has investigated the death of oil workers in numerous accidents on drilling platforms. Concern has arisen about the agency's possible demise amid calls for energy deregulation by Trump's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. The new director of the Bureau is an oil industry ally, Scott Angell, who has called for an era of government cooperation with the oil industry. Weeks after the 2016 election, the agency was dealt a blow in the courts, which sided with industry and ruled that the Bureau had no authority to hold oil rig contractors liable for violations that could lead to spills, injuries, or deaths. By early 2017, the agency appeared to have abandoned what was once a priority, getting industry to report near misses with the aim of averting catastrophes. According to a 2013 study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, oil workers are now 7 times more likely than the average U.S. worker to die on the job. In late April, Flint, Michigan activist Leanne Walters won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Award for leading a grassroots campaign to test the city's tainted drinking water. Flint's drinking water was contaminated with lead after state and local officials began using the polluted Flint River as a source for the city's water supply. In 2015, Walter's children tested positive for lead exposure, and one of her twins showed signs of lead poisoning. Walters spearheaded a campaign to demand more water testing and brought in Virginia Tech University professor Mark Edwards, who conducted comprehensive water testing. When hundreds of water samples revealed high levels of lead in the drinking water, public pressure on Michigan Governor Rick Snyder forced the state to stop using the Flint River as the city's main drinking water source. But for all that Walters, Edwards, and Michigan State pediatrician Mona Hanna Atisha did for Flint, the awards follow an all-too-familiar pattern. Flint is more than 50% black, yet prizes for heroism have been the exclusive domain of non-black figures. Black residents who were active in bringing attention to Flint's water crisis have not been recognized. Many African Americans in Flint, observed Derek Z. Jackson, a fellow with the Union for Concerned Scientists, looked like helpless victims relying on non-black doctors and scientists to save them. It's a type of modern racism, Jackson asserts, that appears in many forms all around us. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
As long anticipated, President Trump announced on May 8th the U.S. withdrawal from the International Nuclear Accord with Iran that was negotiated by his predecessor, Barack Obama. While Trump stated that his administration would initiate new sanctions against Iran, the president stands virtually alone in the world with his condemnation of and now decision to leave the nuclear agreement. The other nations that signed the accord with Iran, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, and the EU, all say they will work to preserve the accord despite the U.S. exit. According to UN inspectors, Iran has remained in compliance with terms of the deal in force since 2015. However, with its withdrawal, the U.S. is now in violation of the agreement. In response to Trump's announcement, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said he had ordered his nation's atomic industry organization to be fully prepared to once again start the industrial enrichment of uranium without limitations. Many observers fear that the U.S. withdrawal will strengthen hardliners inside Iran and provoke a new nuclear arms race and conflicts across the Middle East. Your reporter spoke with Gareth Porter, independent investigative journalist and author of the book Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Here, Porter assesses the dangerous consequences that could result from President Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Iran nuclear agreement.
Just to start with the dire consequences for the Iranian side, particularly if you consider the Iranian side to be the government of, you know, President Rouhani, this is a government that, although it is clearly not a single faction controlling the policy completely, represents a point of view on Iranian foreign policy, which is still quite favorable to integration of Iran into the global economic system, as well as into a set of relationships with Western countries, including the United States and also, of course, key European states. That has been an aim of Iranian foreign policy for many years, and this government is in line with that aim completely. But it is under great pressure at home from a much more powerful nationalist political views and political factions, which have been extremely critical of the agreement with the United States to begin with. So from the point of view of the Iranian government, this is a big blow, not only to their policy, but also to their political position within the Iranian political system. I think that it means that they will be under increasing pressure to take a much harder line, clearly, and will face political consequences at home from their point of view if they don't take a much harder line, meaning that they respond with some fairly strong changes in their policy toward the nuclear program, at the very least resuming the enrichment program in some fashion. And I would suspect at least having some nominal enrichment at higher level, if only very limited, to show that they are not going to be limited in that regard. So I think that is the very least that we can expect from Iran in terms of response to this.
Gareth Porter, with Trump's withdrawal from this international nuclear accord, will other nations that sign the accord be able to hold it together, or is the whole thing fall apart?
No, I don't think that the European states, the UK, Germany, and France, will be able to hold it together. I think they've been striving mightily to do that in their contacts with Iran, of course, but also logically, necessarily, in their contacts with the Trump administration and with Trump himself. But I think the lesson of the past few months is that there is no way to square the circle. There's no way that the Europeans can continue to have a deal with Iran in the absence of a commitment by the United States to do this. And in part, that's because the United States wields this economic power over Europe and makes it very difficult for Europeans to continue to have a deal with Iran that would be sufficiently rewarding to Iran so that Iran has a real incentive to continue in some way with, an agreement that is not with the United States but only with Europe.
Gareth, I wanted to ask you this. Explain to our audience the kind of endgame that Trump, his newly appointed National Security Advisor John Bolton, and newly confirmed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, what do they have in mind in terms of an endgame with Iran if this accord no longer exists? It seems that with all the saber-rattling we've heard from these individuals and Donald Trump himself, that they're not too subtle about the idea that they'd like to go to war with Iran. At least that's what it appears on the surface. What are your thoughts?
Well, I can't disagree fundamentally with that analysis. I think that if we go back and look at what John Bolton's history is on Iran, when he was in the policymaking position in the George W. Bush administration from 2001 to 2005, he was very deeply involved in a scheme to try to wreck any possibility of an international agreement that would prevent or would make it more difficult politically, let's put it that way, for the Bush administration, and of course, particularly Vice President Dick Cheney, to plan for a use of military force against Iran. I have no doubt that Bolton really means what he says. He's been calling for bombing Iran for many years as a commentator on Fox News, and every time I've seen him talk about Iran over the years, he always says, yes, we should bomb Iran. So I think that's what we're up against here with the Trump administration. I must say that we have to view the next 2.5 years of the Trump administration as one of really grave danger for world peace and for the United States.
That was Gareth Porter, independent investigative journalist and author of the book Manufactured Crisis: The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump regime's decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
When the Trump administration came to Washington in January 2017, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt was among the president's most controversial cabinet appointees. Long before Pruitt took over at EPA, he was well known for his climate change denier views and close relationship with the fossil fuel industry when he earlier served as Oklahoma Attorney General. While Attorney General, Pruitt had filed 14 lawsuits on behalf of the state attempting to overturn EPA air and water quality standards. But after more than a year in office, Pruitt is now tangled in a web of multiple scandals, including racking up over-the-top first-class travel expenses, lavish spending on dubious security measures, an ethically questionable decision to rent a room in Washington, D.C., tied to an energy lobbyist, and a taxpayer-financed trip to Morocco to discuss the export of natural gas on behalf of a lobbyist friend. While the Republican-controlled Congress has taken a few modest steps to begin scrutinizing some of the many scandals now plaguing Pruitt, the EPA head has succeeded in pursuing the Trump administration's agenda of dismantling critical functions and enforcement capacity of the agency. Your reporter spoke with Neela Banerjee, senior Washington, D.C. correspondent with Inside Climate News, who discusses her recent article titled Pruitt's EPA is on the verge of regulatory capture, which finds that EPA decisions are now based on industry priorities instead of the public interest.
The EPA, in its 47-year history, is at the closest point to having its agenda dictated by industry rather than by the central precepts of its founding, and that is the protection of human health and the environment. There is a team of 10 researchers who worked on this study. It's in a peer-reviewed journal. And what they did was they looked at the history of Scott Pruitt's EPA in, you know, over the last year or so, and the various steps it's taken to basically roll back all sorts of regulations, not just in the climate space, but on other issues as well. The researchers also succeeded in interviewing, I think, about 45 current and former EPA staff members, including people who'd been there in previous years when other administrations, most notably under Ronald Reagan, tried to roll back regulations. But from what they've seen as far as the speed and ambition of what Pruitt is trying to do, what the veterans have seen of about what's happening under Trump versus what was happening under Reagan, they think that this goes much farther than anything else that's happened in the agency's history.
Now, I wanted to ask you about Pruitt's role here, because he seems to have struck out a real, I think, quirky place for himself in the agency, in that he has conducted his business in real secrecy and trying to prevent information flowing to other staff people in the agency, the careerists who've been there for many years, many decades, trying to keep them isolated. Maybe just speak to the covert action of what's going on inside the EPA right now.
There's a real dismissiveness about the expertise that exists within the EPA. And I think this feeds into the broader narrative within the Trump administration and those who support Trump, that you have this quote-unquote deep state that works against the interests of Americans, and therefore anything they say is suspect. And so Pruitt has been operating off that by basically cutting off access to the administrator's office of a lot of career scientists and other staffers. That sort of exclusion of expertise has extended to other bodies that exist that are linked to EPA. For example, EPA has these scientific advisory boards that are staffed mainly by academics, but also some members of industry. But it's definitely tilted towards independent academics. And Pruitt has worked to make sure that there are fewer academics and a lot more people from industry. So, again, you know, that kind of independent expertise is being set aside to push forward an agenda that helps industry that was basically known about. Scott Pruitt is very much keeping in line with his history predating his time at EPA.
Neela, I wanted to ask you about the intersection between the many scandals roiling around Scott Pruitt that have captured many more headlines than his dismantling of EPA internal policies and regulations. But what is the intersection between these scandals where it seems like he's doing all sorts of very lucrative favors for his friends in the fossil fuel industry and others, and blatantly violating many ethical rules?
Right. So Mr. Pruitt currently faces 11 investigations. Most of them are probably through the Inspector General's office. But there are 11 separate investigations into decisions he's made, like the money that was spent on this soundproof chamber or booth where he holds certain conversations, to his use of first-class tickets. But where his decision to kind of bypass traditional ethics intersects with his support of fossil fuel agenda has been his housing decisions in D.C. So if you'll recall, last year, between February and August, for about 6 months or so, he was paying $50 a night to stay at a very nice condominium in Capitol Hill that's owned by the wife of an energy lobbyist. The gentleman in question, Stephen Hart, said that he didn't have any business before EPA. He wasn't an energy lobbyist. But basically, journalists, you know, looked at filings by his company, and people did a lot of research and found out that his company at least does lobbying on energy, that he had also reached out to EPA last August on behalf of a client of his, Smithfield Foods, which is a major meat processing concern. And so it would be one thing if he stayed in property owned by a lobbyist at a cut-rate price. But the fact that the lobbyist works on issues that are within the purview of EPA shows this kind of intersection of his priorities and his certain attitudes towards ethical guidelines.
That was Neela Banerjee, senior Washington, D.C. correspondent with Inside Climate News. Find a link to Banerjee's article, Pruitt's EPA is on the Verge of Regulatory Capture, and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. April 22nd marked the grand opening of the first Palestinian museum in the U.S. Tucked into a modern office building along a suburban road, not far from downtown New Haven, Connecticut, the Palestine Museum U.S. is the creation of a Palestinian-American businessman and entrepreneur, Faisal Saleh. Members of Faisal's large and prosperous family were among the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians forced out of their homes when the State of Israel was declared on May 14, 1948. Each year, Palestinians commemorate May 15th as the Nakba, Arabic for catastrophe. The exhibits at the museum, paintings, photos, crafts, and historical items, fill several rooms and hallways of a building that Saleh owns. On display are works by Palestinian artists living in the Middle East, as well as those scattered in the global diaspora. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus visited the museum and spoke with Saleh about what motivated him to pursue the museum project, how he succeeded, and the response it has generated thus far.
Really thinking about, you know, what's going on in the U.S. and around the world, there's really a vacuum of Palestinian media, and particularly when it comes to art and culture. And Israel and its friends have many, many museums everywhere, many cities in the U.S., and the Palestinians did not have a single museum in all of North America and South America. So that vacuum really is crying out for some presence, and that's really why I wanted to take this initiative.
And how did you get the different items, the different artists who are exhibited here?
Well, I began the process of researching the Palestinian artists mainly through Facebook, and I began making contacts with these artists. And initially, it was difficult to get an artist to agree to exhibit at the museum and send us their artwork kind of sight unseen. However, after a while, once we got a couple of names under our belt, particularly, there's an artist, a Palestinian artist who is very famous, who lives in the U.S., in New York. That's Samia Halabi. I made contacts with her, and she came out here and had a lot of questions for me. And after vetting us very thoroughly, she said she really liked what we're doing, and so that was a great idea. And she said, you will have three of my paintings on loan to exhibit. And after that, that was really a turning point. After that, it became much easier to get artists to send us their work. And after the coverage we've had recently on the international media outlets, everybody wants to send us their art now. So we have a huge pipeline of work. We're just waiting to decide on.
I think I read you quoted as saying at some point that when people in the U.S. talk about Palestinians or talk about the West Bank or talk about Gaza, it's all about politics and fighting, and most people in the U.S. have a very one-dimensional view of Palestinians, and that part of your goal was to make the Palestinian people sort of more three-dimensional. Is that right?
That's true. I mean, the media in the U.S. in particular and the West in general kind of focused on violence and conflict and terrorism and things like that. And kind of portrayed Palestinians in a negative light, if you will. The average American doesn't really know much about Palestine and Palestinian. They think Palestine is Israel, and they think hummus and falafel are Israeli food. The Palestinian culture has been raped, in our opinion, and we Palestinians are out to reclaim our culture. Falafel is a Palestinian food, but had been a Palestinian food for hundreds of years. So we hope that by exhibiting all the art, the Palestinian art, and showing the historic photographs, that we can provide the American audience with a picture of who the Palestinians are and show that they're really human beings like everybody else. And they have the artists, and they have people who excel in the arts, the musicians and the people that do the crafts and the photographers and all that. And our goal is to change the discourse from the political arena to the cultural artistic arena.
You said it's not political, but there's a big painting in there. There's one big painting that seems to be very political. You know which one I'm talking about?
The Rachel Corrie Memorial?
Yeah. I should just say, Rachel Corrie was a young college student in her early 20s who did go to Gaza and worked, basically was run over and killed by a bulldozer when she was defending a family's home in Gaza. So how did you decide to include that one? It's probably the biggest one in the whole exhibit, yeah, isn't it?
It's a mural. Mm-hmm. It's an 18-foot by 8-foot mural. I felt that, you know, Rachel Corrie was such a brave selfless person that, you know, why would a young woman like her leave her comfortable life in Olympia, Washington, and go to like one of the worst places on earth? And she lost her life in something she believed in, and it was a tragedy. And, you know, we're not concerned about whose fault it is and whatever, but we're concerned about her sacrifice. And the Palestinians honor her everywhere.
That was Faisal Sayla, founder and executive director of the Palestine Museum U.S. Sayla says his museum is a proof of concept that he hopes can be moved to a bigger city in the near future. Learn more about the Palestine Museum by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Radio Helsinki in Graz, Austria. GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, KOPA in Pala, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
American Holocaust. In his in-depth and exhaustive work on the American Holocaust, entitled A Little Matter of Genocide, author and political activist Ward Churchill distills the narrative of the embryonic American empire. In his 1782 plan, Washington advanced the unequivocal belief that after all was said and done, the objective of federal policy should be to force the entire indigenous population east of the Mississippi River into the illimitable regions of the West, to which the United States was not yet pressing claims. Those who physically resisted such a fate in any way would have to be broken by force, or, as Thomas Jefferson bluntly put it, exterminated. This removal policy was in keeping with a sense of manifest destiny, an outlook founded in precisely the same matrix of virulent Anglo-Saxon supremacism that would later give rise to Nazi Aryanist ideology, already pronounced among American leaders and citizens alike. As the fledgling America grew, it seemed as if the country was drunk on the elixir manifest destiny. The culture at the time bristled with constant references. Poet Walt Whitman was typical. Here he weighs in on the march of civilization, clearly following the sun as it roared to the west in his poem, Facing West from California Shores. Facing west from California shores, inquiring, tireless, seeking what is yet unfound. I, a child, very old, over waves towards the house of maternity, the land of migrations, look afar. Look off the shores of my western sea, the circle almost circled, for starting westward from Hindustan, from the vales of Kashmir, from Asia, from the north, from the god, the sage, and the hero. From the south, from the flowery peninsulas and the spice islands, long having wandered since, round the earth having wandered, now I face home again, very pleased and joyous. White supremacy was well entrenched in almost every aspect of 19th century American life. The foundation was deep and well-rooted, having started with Columbus hacking his way around the Caribbean, followed by the religious zeal oozing out of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And then it became official when the best and the brightest of colonial America made it gospel. There was no doubt the sun of civilization was moving again, this time across a landmass made up of many nations with names like Shawnee, Choctaw, Cherokee, Apache, Sioux, Pawnee, Cheyenne, Crow, Blackfoot, Shoshone, Ute, Navajo, and Paiute, among many others. The Indian nations could not have known nor calculated what was about to hit them, but it would have a name, the American Holocaust. From the screenplay to the 1990 film Dances with Wolves, directed by Kevin Costner and written by Michael Blake, Kicking Bird and Dances with Wolves are alone. Each man is preoccupied with his own thoughts. Dances with Wolves. You have asked me many times about the white people. You always ask how many more are coming. Long pause as they exchange glances. There will be a lot, my friend. More than can be counted. Kicking Bird. Help me know how many. Dances with wolves, like the stars. This is what Kicking Bird wanted to know, and it hits him like a rock. Kicking Bird bows his head in thought, while Dances with Wolves raises his. He never wanted to say this. He wishes it wasn't true. It makes me afraid for all the Sioux. Flash forward to the end of the 19th century. Once the extermination and removal policy wrapped up on the North American continent, America began to look beyond her shores, across the peaceful shining sea to the west, where the Philippines and their guileless people lay waiting for conquest, and the ugly formula for its destiny remained the same. Any difference of culture or language will do, writes historian Reginald Horseman, and the power of racism to facilitate the worst sorts of human behavior is well established. Horseman continues with a bare, naked look at a United States Senator's Guide to Colonial Adventures. Senator Albert J. Beveridge, Republican, Indiana, offered the Senate his own divinely guided rationale for war on the Philippines. God has not been preparing the English-speaking and Teutonic peoples for 1,000 years for nothing but vain and idle self-contemplation and self-admiration. No, he has marked the American people as his chosen nation to finally lead in the redemption of the world. Linguist, philosopher, and historian Noam Chomsky looks back on the march of manifest destiny and its iron-fisted colonial conquest, and sums it up this way. Most imperialist countries leave the population there and try to rule over them and exploit them. Settler colonialism, the most savage kinds, exterminates them. Mark Twain also recognized the savageness of America's imperial nature. In fact, he was so moved by the battle hymn of the Republic, he felt compelled to write additional lyrics in 1901. Mine eyes have seen the orgy of the launching of the sword. He is searching out the hoardings where the stranger's wealth is stored. He hath loosed his fateful lightnings and with woe and death has scored. His lust is marching on. Follow the money. This European opulence is literally scandalous, for it has been founded on slavery. It has been nourished with the blood of slaves, and it comes directly from the soil and the subsoil of that underdeveloped world. The well-being and the progress of Europe have been built up with the sweat and the dead bodies of Negroes, Arabs, Indians, and the yellow races. The writings of Frantz Fanon, the wretched of the earth. There is no doubt that religious fervor combined with the moral imperative to civilize a new continent infested with savages was a major force behind the European modus operandi responsible for the occupation, settlement, and subsequent genocidal maelstrom unleashed in the titular New World. But one doesn't need to dig too deep to find the profit motive rumbling like rolling thunder just below the surface. In fact, in all things geopolitical, it's like what Deep Throat tells Bob Woodward in All the President's Men. Follow the money. The same pretext and justification used to exterminate the indigenous population was also used to validate and defend the enslavement of Africans in the young and growing nation, a nation founded in genocide and built by slavery. Complete discussion in Chapter 5. Many tend to dismiss the horrors and murderous brutality of American slavery as an isolated antebellum southern thing or a misguided tributary of American history. But as Dr. James Horton of George Washington University sums up America's economic growth, which at the time was the envy of the world, slavery was not a sideshow. It was the main event. The power centers in Europe, families, governments, and companies, created, organized, and controlled slavery throughout the Americas. And as the 17th and 18th centuries unfolded in the American colonies, slavery became a time-honored American institution. Current critics of historians and writers who position slavery as a gruesome cancer central to American history, as well as a disgrace for its chiseled-in-stone heroes, usually camouflage their protection of the benevolent and kindly apostles of American exceptionalism as humans caught up in the realities of their time. Let's repeat that for emphasis, caught up in the realities of their time. Here's a classic explanation. Read Historical Delusion by a mainstream academic historian from Rutgers University in a 2004 U.S. News and World Report article. Other scholars believe the Founding Fathers can best be seen squarely within their time. To contextualize is not to excuse, says Rutgers University historian Jan Lewis, who concludes, it's to show the complexity. Understanding the early leaders' severe lapse in judgment over slavery, say Lewis and other historians, makes their ability to found a new and democratic nation all the more incredible. But it's not enough to simply contextualize and vindicate. Some push beyond myth-making toward erasure. You've been listening to Murder Incorporated, Part 1, Dreaming of Empire, written by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show today, so I'm going to just intro it really quick. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with filmmaker David Zeiger and artist Perry Hoberman on the event that they're presenting coming up very shortly, in about 2 weeks, I guess, Is It Fascism and What Can We Do About It? Two films and two panels about 2 weeks from now. All right, so that's, and Dave and Perry will be in to talk with us today about this anti-fascist film festival that they're holding, all right? And before that, we'll be listening to a piece from Bob Avakian from his film, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America, a better world as possible. And we'll talk more about that as we get to it. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be bringing back to the show Stanley Cohen. Stanley's a radical lawyer and human rights activist. And we're going to be talking with him about When Zionism Rubs Up Against Reality, a piece that he just recently wrote. And basically, I'm just going to jump right into this because I want to get as much time to talk with him as possible. Stanley, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for inviting me again. Always a pleasure to share some time with you and your audience.
Good, good. Well, we enjoy sharing time with you too, so let's jump into it. The title of your piece, and I should tell people, if they want to read the whole piece, it's in the April 13th edition of Counterpunch, and it's titled When Zionism Rubs Up Against Reality. But you introduce your piece by referring to the comments of the chief counsel for the United States, which opened up the Nuremberg trials and the prosecution of Nazi war criminals. Let's talk about that. How come?
Well, look, you know, history is nothing else. If we're not disciplined and principled and consistent, it guarantees to repeat itself, and all too often it's the most ugliest repetition imaginable. I mean, we went to great pains at the end of World War II to hold the Nuremberg tribunals, multiple trials of Nazi war criminals, which included political leaders and military leaders and judicial leaders and ranking soldiers and politicians, to hold a tribunal for basically the first time in certainly recent history, if not ever, in which we preached from on high about the need of holding accountable officials that embrace, that enforce, that oversee crimes against humanity, war crimes, in particular crimes that target civilians on the basis of their race, their religion, their politics, their belief, their gender, their sexual orientation. And multiple Nazi war criminals were held to account for pretty much identical war crimes that today can be laid at the feet of Israel and have for 70 years. So I started with Nuremberg because, you know, obviously a prime group, if not the prime group, that was subjected to war crimes and crimes against humanity on the basis of race, religion, politics, et cetera, during that time were Jews. And here we are 70 years later, 73 years later, that, you know, the people that were victimized, and it wasn't just the Jews in the Holocaust, because, you know, there were millions of gypsies and communists and anarchists and Christians and artists and gay women and men and activists who were also slaughtered by the regime. But as a group, you know, the Holocaust rings ever present in the mind of so many people today, and the paradox that we began with the Nuremberg Tribunal 73 years ago, and now we find ourselves, the victims, becoming the victimizers and engaging in the identical conduct, which resulted in many dozens of Nazis being hauled before an international tribunal and charged with offenses, some of whom ended up committing suicide. I believe some who were actually executed. And to really twist it on its head, a good many of them ended up being released, including some that ended up going to Western countries to help them with their missile programs and other munition efforts. But the connection that I wanted to draw was Nuremberg, victims, 73 years later, victimizers. And if you're going to apply international human rights law, the law of war, war crimes and genocide, you've got to be consistent. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to be consistent, that means tribunals, and that means the leadership of the Israeli occupation force. That means the political, military, and even rabbinical leaders to some degree in Israel have to be held accountable as well today under well-settled law.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's step back for a minute because I want to get into that, but I also want to explore this a little bit too, because there's a way that this is happening, repeating itself now, and you get into that later in the article. But there's a way that this thing of what you say that what the Nazis did, you know, look, basically, well, what the Nazis did wasn't a secret, but the world chose to look away. And you called it a well-calculated historical rewrite that stripped the Jewish people their history, culture, and collective purpose and decency. And then you dive into how this history is repeating itself in relation to the state of Israel today. I think it's important for people to sort of grapple with that a little bit. So can we talk about that a little?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's you know, sure. The ovens, the boxcars, the assassinations, the slaughters, that's well documented. But it just doesn't happen overnight. And it's very much, as I call, the grand lie of Israel. And Israel does the same thing today. Everything is rewritten. Everything is a lie. Everything is an excuse. Everything is a pretext. You know, propaganda, Hasbara, far more effective and efficient today than it was even in the run-up to World War II. But it lays the groundwork for the kind of ongoing, unbroken violation of human rights and war crimes that we're seeing today. And that's what the Nazis did in the 30s, leading up to World War II, where they began to control the means of communication, where they began to close newspapers, where they began to close, you know, radio stations, where they began to ban meetings and discussions and newspapers, and they took over the party line. They controlled what it was that people were allowed to discuss, to view, the vision of the times, the grand lie, the grand rewrite. So people suddenly were cast based upon their religion, were cast based upon their ethnicity, were based upon their language in a certain light. And that's exactly what Israel has perfected, far better than the Nazis ever did 70 years ago. They've done since literally the Nakba began in 1948, and it continues on right now. So you have, in the last several weeks, the slaughter, and again, there were three young martyrs today in Gaza, the border, where, you know, Israel completely rewrites events that are unfolding in front of the world, where the narrative is always controlled, where Israel controls what large swaths of the public are able to see, what they can read, where there are boards of censorship that are controlling dissemination from newspapers that have the power to vet stories, where you have in the West, where you have Israel using organizations such as AIPAC and other, for example, anti-BDS movements and organizations to control the narrative, the grand rewrite, the historical lie, the excuse, which turns Israel today into the victims. They're the people under siege, and that's exactly what happened in the run-up to World War II, where the German people were under siege by foreign elements, by communists, by Jews, by anarchists. They control the narrative, and from there, the march to murder, the march to boxcars, the march to mass slaughter is a very straight line and easy.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Stanley Cohen, radical lawyer and human rights activist, and we're talking about something that's coming off of an article he recently wrote and published in Counterpunch, and it's called When Zionism Rubs Up Against Reality. And Stanley's an attorney, and he's represented hackers, Occupy activists, homeless, anti-war protesters, Muslim clerics, American Indian activists, and Anonymous in the PayPal 14 case. And he still keeps kicking butt as we're going along. So I really want to jump into this more, because you were just talking about all this thing about this, and you mentioned in your piece that there's a selective reality and expedient deception in operation in relation to Israel. What is this, and what's been the consequences of this?
Well, it picks and chooses, and by the way, just for purposes of full disclosure, I just happened to represent the Hamas for 20 years. So I've been very much involved on the ground. This is not some sort of abstract, you know, intellectual area of interest to me. Until Israel banned me and until Egypt has now banned me, I've been to Palestine, I don't know, 10, 15 times and represented Hamas, the leadership of Hamas, and other Palestinian organizations. So I've had the benefit of on the ground. So the selective reality is, you know, Israel will focus on a quote, lone wolf attack. Whether it's a little missile, and I mean firecrackers taped together that land in the desert coming out of Gaza, or whether it's a 17-year-old kid who can't take it anymore and attacks a soldier with a scissors, they'll take that and they'll exploit it. They'll manipulate it. They'll expand it. They'll twist it into some sort of, you know, massive policy of Palestinian resistance that's organized, that's designed to go after settlements as whole, and then they lay the ground for the excuse. And the next thing you know, there are bombing runs and attacks, and 10, 20, 30, 50, 100, 2,000, 2,500 civilians are killed as a result of this selective pick and choose of events. And once the quote response is unleashed, there's a rewrite of that. So everyone becomes a front for Hamas. Everyone becomes, you know, all of a sudden, resistance groups become terrorist organizations. All of a sudden, kids who were bombed, people that are United Nations centers that are hit, UNRWA stations, shelters that are bombed with dozens on occasion, 100, 150 children, women, and the elderly killed. It's an unfortunate price of war because, quote, Hamas had mortars 50 yards away, and war can be painful. So it's that continuation of cherry-picking isolated events, blowing them up into a grand lie that is then manipulated and used by their apologists to unleash and justify war crimes. I mean, the essence of the Nuremberg Tribunal, and we're seeing it unfold every Friday now in particular, is you can't target civilian populations. You cannot single out civilians for any use of weapons. There are areas where incidental casualties and damage happen. I have another piece that's coming out in Al Jazeera in the next few days or next week that talks about in the 1850s and 1860s. I mean, there were one particular battle, there were 40,000 military losses and one civilian lost their life. We have gone from civilian casualties at one point being less than 5% of all those casualties in warfare to today where they're 95% of all the casualties in warfare. And most of that is because we now target civilians. And no one does that better or worse than Israel, where Gaza, 2 million civilians are regularly attacked, bombing runs, phosphorus, cluster bombs, poison sprayed on farms, the destructions of animals. So the selective use of history leads into the grand lie and the grand excuse. And what we in the West typically get is, oh, well, you know, things happen. For example, the slaughter that's taken place the last four Fridays, now 4 weeks, at this grand nonviolent civilian peaceful march on the barricades at Gaza, which has resulted now in 35 women and men, mostly young boys, assassinated, most of them shot in the head, in the back of their head or in their back, and some 5,000 wounded and casualties. They don't have weapons. They don't have guns. They don't have rockets. You have this group of snipers that are lined up over the hill that just take pot shots and just kill demonstrators. And of course, Israel twists it and turns it into this mass attempted breakout from what, the world's largest concentration camp? So it's part of this continuum that fascists, the totalitarian regimes have used to manipulate and control the debate, the discussion, the narrative, as an excuse to cover war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide. And no one has been more proficient at that for 70 years now than Israel.
Although I'd posit somebody else is actually pretty proficient at it too, and that's one of the questions I wanted to get into with you, is you rightfully talk about all the horrors that Israel has unleashed against the Palestinian people. But in thinking about it, I was also thinking, well, we would be well-placed, well put to include the working agreement between Israel and the U.S. when it comes to the Palestinian people and the slaughter.
Oh, God. Listen, there's something called the Arms Export Control Act, which was a legislative enactment a number of years ago that there's a class of recipients of weapons. And it's interesting, someone just wrote a piece and talked about the failure of the United States to enforce humanitarian law in exchange for aid from the United States. Well, it's the Arms Export Control Act. It's an act that Sanders has refused. Actually, Senator Leahy's tried to enforce it. Sanders has opposed it. Almost everyone in the Senate is opposed to it. The Arms Export Control Act was a bill that was passed a number of years ago that says, look, if we're going to provide either aid or money or actual weapons to countries, every quarter there has to be a certification based upon international law and based upon independent evaluation that they're not being used in violation of international law. And when it comes to Israel, there's two or three remarkable, unique guideposts of our relationship to Israel. Unlike almost every other country in the world where we provide weapons and money for weapons on a quarterly basis and charge interest, Israel gets a lump sum without interest once a year. Unlike all other recipients under the Arms Export Control Act that have to certify and are certified as compliance of international law every quarter, it's never happened with Israel. Attempts by Congress to force the executive, the president, to apply the Arms Export Control Act have been repeatedly battered down by courts under separation of powers argument. And so what Israel gets is this never-ending either money or never-ending weapons from the United States that are used in this. Bernie Sanders, the great enlightened savior, was the prime pusher in the trillion-dollar F-35 development project because he saw it as a good means to get working people on board in Vermont. Well, later on, it's discovered that two Israeli companies had a piece of the development project. What are F-35 used for? They're used in Israel to drop bombs on Gaza, to murder civilians. So there is this relationship. And it's easy to say, you know, $30 billion, $40 billion, $50 billion. It's abstract. You reach a point that doesn't really hit home. What hits home is when you see a 15-year-old today assassinated by an Israeli sniper just as easily with an American-provided weapon, either provided as a gun or the money for it, shot in the back of the head for what? Carrying a Palestinian flag and screaming, I want to go home? So you're right. You know, you come down to it. There's two subsidies going on here. Subsidy number one is providing weapons from the United States and providing money for weapons from the United States. But every bit as much of a subsidy, and it's part of my next piece that's coming out on Al Jazeera, is the fact that Israel, that the United States has executed, has used the veto power in the Security Council 38 times to protect Israel in the last 15 years. 38 times. They've used it twice in the last 2 weeks or the last 2 months. Once on the move to Jerusalem and now on the attacks going on in Gaza. So they're not only arming Israel, they're not only funding Israel, they're not only closing their eyes to Israel in Congress with the Arms Export Control Act. Whenever the world body gets together, whenever the Security Council says it's enough, when it comes to Israel, there's a veto. So it goes nowhere. Mm-hmm. So it's this combination of economic support, blind obedience, and veto power at the United Nations that has permitted Israel to unleash this war against humanity when it comes to Palestinians now going on 70 years. You know, it's interesting because keep in mind, you know, the United Nations was formed essentially in 1948, as was Israel not much long thereafter. And ever since, the United Nations has been a safeguard for Israel.
Mm-hmm. On that note, Stanley, we're going to have to promise to come back and talk with you again soon in the future, but we have to wrap it up now. So thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. Always
sure.
a pleasure. Look forward to talking to you again.
Me too, Stanley. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Stanley Cohen, radical lawyer and human rights activist, and we've been talking about a piece he had in Counterpunch called When Zionism Rubs Up Against Reality. And as you heard, this is something that people really need to chew on, all right? And if you want to follow Stanley on Twitter, his Twitter handle is at Stanley Cohen Law. And by the way, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do that by using at MichaelSlate195. Once again, that's at MichaelSlate195. Lots of interesting stuff on that. We're going to take a quick – or actually what I want to say to people first is if you want to find out more about the case of Israel, if you want to find out more about Israel and what the hell's going on with there, you can find a really brilliant article called The Case of Israel, Bastion of Enlightenment or Enforcer of Imperialism. And you can find that at revcom.us. And when you get to revcom.us, just go to the just click on the link to Revolution Newspaper. All right. So again, that's revcom.us, Revolution Newspaper, and The Case of Israel, Bastion of Enlightenment or Enforcer for Imperialism. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. So stay tuned.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
There you go. We will not go down in the night without a fight. All right. Given the topics we have today, and even more so, everything that's going on in the world every day, every night, all the time, it's a hellified world out there now. And I really want people to actually jump into this film of a talk by Bob Avakian. And it's incredibly important, folks. It's really, you know, it's a film called The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. And we're talking about a regime, U.S. imperialism, that could destroy civilization. And you think you know, but you don't know. But if you dig into this film, you're going to find out what you need to know, what you know, what you need to know, and you're going to be dealing with how do we actually take it on and stop this, all right? So I'm really, really pleased to be bringing to you another segment from the talk by Bob Avakian, from the film of a talk by Bob Avakian. And the segment is part of the questions and answers that followed the talk he gave last autumn. So let's just jump right into that now.
One of the ways that the Vietnam War was lost in Berkeley is that at that time we had independent news media that actually had voices from the left that were against the war regularly appearing in America's living rooms at a time when most people only had three channels to choose from. Now we have this huge multinational corporate news media that's fractured into 1,000 pieces. And even still, though it is fractured into 1,000 pieces, people from You Refuse Fascism can barely get on air, and even then it's only on Fox News. Okay, Democracy Now! Won't even have people from Refuse Fascism on air to speak, much less MSNBC. So my question to you is, what sort of strategies do you think that we can come up with to get through this? Because one of the reasons that we don't see the sort of searching questions like you were asking about Pence, like, do you believe in evolution, are not asked is because the corporations that control our news media don't want them to be asked. They want that status quo to be maintained, and they will instruct their news professionals, half of whom don't even have journalism degrees, to maintain that status quo.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very important question. I think there are different elements to the strategy. For one thing, you know, people who do have some prominence, for that, and it is hard for these media, these dominating media you're talking about, to ignore, you know, have to be struggled with and won, you know, to use their own influence to get on those channels and, I mean, those networks and put this out. For example, I'm thinking of, you know, back in the, like, I don't remember exactly when it was, but some time ago, but later than the 60s, I remember there was this scene on television where the L.A. sheriffs were brutally beating this immigrant. And Marlon Brando called up Larry King, who was then on CNN, and said, I want to come on and talk about this. And he did. You know, and then they attacked him, you know, for other things. But, you know, but that's one example where you struggle with people who do have the kind of prominence that it's hard. In other words, look, a lot of this is you're dealing with contradictions, and we have to know how to understand and deal with them well. The contradiction is that the media is, in fact, an instrument of the ruling forces of this system. But it pretends to be a free press. It pretends to be the voice of the people and so on and so on, you know, that, so on and so forth. So that's a contradiction you have to, you know, figure out how to turn to advantage. You know, how do you take advantage of the aspect where they're pretending to be, you know, a free press and not to be an official state media or whatever, you know, to and that's what, you know, someone like Marlon Brando did. You know, he said, okay, look, you know, if you refuse to have me on here, then, you know, you're going to expose yourself as what you are. So they didn't want to not have Marlon Brando on because he had enough prominence that, he would find other ways to let it be known what he wanted to say and that they wouldn't let him say it in that medium. So that's one leg or one element I can see. Another is, you know, hey, let's you know, I mean, I know some of this is done by Refuse Fascism with the panels at Fox News. You know, but how about, you know, look, you know, someone like Amy Goodman does some good things, you know, but she also, you know, has a certain, you know, she has a certain limited framework that she wants things to stay within. Let's put it that way. You know, but, and, you know, certain people she wants to promote and she wants to promote those things that they're affiliated with, like, you know, ultimately the Democratic Party, to just get right down to it. But, you know, I saw the other day she had on Michael Moore, who's got his problems too. No, I mean, look, you know, we don't get perfect people, okay? You know, people are contradictory, you know, and they do good things one minute and then the next minute they, you know, they fall back into things that aren't helpful. But I did notice that he was on Amy Goodman and he was saying some stuff that was wrong about why Trump got elected, you know, this whole idea about the white working class is suffering so badly economically. And yes, there are people in Appalachia and other places, but that's not essentially what elected Trump. You know, I mean, even though he comes from a different place than I do, I did think the article by Ta-Nehisi Coates in the Atlantic got a lot more to the truth of this, including pointing out that every category of white people that you could think of voted for Trump. Now, some of them, like people with college degrees, it was a very small majority. In others, it was a bigger majority. But every single category of white people voted for Trump. That's why he said Trump is the first white president. You know, he ran openly on the basis of white supremacy. So I don't agree with Michael Moore about that, and that's tied in with some deeper things that I don't agree with him about. But he was saying some important things. I guess he's doing this show on Broadway, The Terms of My Surrender, which is, you know, laying out from his point of view what would be required to get him to stop protesting, I guess, is the essence of it. I don't know if people have gone to that show, but, you know, he does involve the audience. And, you know, if they have, good. And if we should keep going back and get up and make statements. You know, I will say that on Amy Goodman, he was, you know, in addition to some of the things he said I thought were really wrong, he was saying some very important things, including he said, look, Trump is going to start a war. And when he starts a war, don't listen to the Democratic Party establishment that tells you you have to support this war. Get out and protest this war. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a good and important thing he said. And he said, look, you know, I don't think this is the exact analogy, but it's coming from a good place. look, we're in the French Resistance now, referring to the French Resistance against the Nazi occupation of France in World War II. You know, we got to make sacrifices. You know, and obviously he's talking to a certain stratum of people. He said, you know, your kids got to be driven to soccer class. They can walk for a year. We got to get out. You know, you're having trouble in your marriage. You know, got to go to marriage counseling. Get along for another year. We got to get out here. You know, and you could see, you know, what he was getting at. You know, he's doing it with a certain amount of humor. But, you know, he was saying, look, this is what we got to do. And this is important. So people like that, we should be trying different. We should be going to the front of that show and leafleting with refused fascism material. We should be going inside and getting up and in a friendly way, not in an antagonistic way, speaking up from the audience, you know, and calling on him to endorse and support and call on other people to be part of this. We should try to talk to him directly. And there are all different kinds of ways. You know, Amy Goodman, well, if she steadfastly refuses to put people from Refused Fascism on there, some people from Refused Fascism should go down to where she's broadcasting and make a stink, you know, and say, put us on there. You know, it's not acceptable. I mean, it's not acceptable that you don't let this, you know, voice be out there. And that you say that you stand for certain things. Well, this is, you know, something that falls within what you claim to stand for. So, I mean, the most I've seen is she does let a lot of the no signs. She'll show them, but she won't let people come on. Okay, well, you know, we don't have to accept that. You don't have to treat her as if she's in the camp of the enemy, but it's wrong what she's doing. We don't have to accept it. You know, look, we ourselves have to act, and I'm not saying people aren't, but I'm just saying this is an important principle for us. We have to mean what we say, and we have to act on the basis of what we're saying to other people. We're saying that, you know, this is a deadly serious matter. We're saying that it's intolerable that this regime remain in power. We're saying that, you know, that we can't just go along with a normal routine. Well, then we can't. Then we have to go and do things that are way outside the norms of what we're used to doing also. Find creative ways where people are, you know, broadly speaking on the right side of things, but they're doing things wrong. We should call them out, but not treat them like the enemy. We should struggle against them. We should expose it when they do things that are wrong and not just wrong, but harmful, that hurt what needs to happen without pushing them into the camp of the enemy. There are a lot of creative things, but, you know, it requires of us that we act in accordance with what we're saying is the case, which it is, in fact, the case. So there are a lot of different stratagems, if you want to use that word. Getting people who do have prominence, you know, pushing on them. Look, I heard a story, and, you know, I referred during my talk to the article I wrote, you know, the question of challenge for Paul Krugman and all those concerned about the future of humanity. You know, I heard a story about somebody went to talk to somebody about that article, and they said, and the person they were talking to said, well, what does Paul think of this article? Because they know Paul Krugman. And the answer was, well, we sent it to him, but we haven't heard an answer. That's not good enough. You know, you should say to that person, well, you know, that's what's happened. How about you? Since you know him, how about you send the article to him? How about you tell him this is something important you ought to read? How about you help us, you know, getting to where we can sit down and talk with him? There are a lot of things people can do that don't require them, you know, to you know, from our point of view, to join a revolution tomorrow, you know, or to become full-time activists and refuse fascism tomorrow. A lot of we should think creatively. How can people contribute in ways that correspond to what they, you know, can be shown would be important for them to do, without it being a full commitment? Then we can struggle. You need to get fully committed, but. But, you know, in the meantime, let's find ways that people can contribute who would like to contribute, but we don't help them, you know, find the ways to do that. So we need to get better at that also, you know. And so all these different kind of things, the main current running through all this, if you will, is that we really have to be creative because the situation demands it of us. We have to not accept, you know, no, yes, but we have to not accept no for an answer. And on a different plane, you know, no idea.
Okay, we'll just shoot for it then.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, and that was taken from his piece. His piece, his speech, the film of his speech, the Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war. A meanness swept the land, stealing our hearts and the hands of time, taking us back in history to a place on the darker side, where we saluted the flags of fear and the voice of ignorance roared. I've taken us back to Germany just before the war.
All right, welcome back. That was Sonny Meadows with Just Like Germany Before the War. All right, and a lot of people, whenever I play that, people write in and say, oh, I got to get that, man. Well, it's Sonny Meadows, Just Like Germany Before the War. And yeah, it's the theme song for today, okay? Because that's where we're at and what we need to be thinking about.
Now, I want to say a word about the segment that we're about to hear. I interviewed filmmaker David Zeiger and artist Perry Hoberman about an important film screening they're presenting. Is it fascism and what can we do about it? Two films and two panels. Now, this is happening in Los Angeles, but it's something that should spread everywhere. Anti-fascist art and culture is vital right now for the future of humanity, to inspire and to help people figure out what's happening with the fascist Trump-Pence regime. And, as the name of the screening puts it, what can we do about it?
All right. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show two people who I know, and I know what they do, and they do good work, filmmaker David Zeiger and artist Perry Hoberman. And both of them have been on the show previously, but they're actually coming today to talk about an event that they are presenting, and it's called Is It Fascism and What Can We Do About It? That's actually – is that the overall title, Dave?
Yes.
Is It Fascism and What Can We Do About It? And it's featuring two films and two panels. So, David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad Perry, to be here.
Perry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well, glad to be here.
Yeah, I really like the way you're dressed today, man. It's like real – All right, folks, because Perry is on – Perry is over the phone line, so that was a little –
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway – let's jump into this. David, let's start with you. Is it fascism and what can we do about it? This series of events, what – tell people – give people an overview of what it's about.
Okay. Several months ago, Perry and I started getting together and trying to work out doing a film festival, an anti-fascist film festival. And this thing has evolved over time to what I think – what we're hoping will be a series, a film series that we'll be doing this regularly. And for me – the point here and the question is there's really nothing, I guess, nothing more important right now than this question of is it fascism, meaning, of course, the Trump-Pence regime. And what – is that an accurate description of what's going on? And in that context, what do people do about it? How do you confront it? And one of the things that's – I think that's been really interesting over the last year is that this – the – understanding of what happened in Germany and how it happened has become a very big topic, not just in universities, but there have been books published and much has been revealed, I think, about the lead up to this consolidation of fascism in Germany. And a lot of it, as a whole lot of people have pointed out, is very relevant to today. So I'm a filmmaker and a cinephile, and I believe that film can have play a very important role in this debate and discussion. It's not the end all and be all of it, but it can spark it can really spark some real discussion and some real understanding. So these two films that we're presenting on Sunday, May 6th, this is films, and then we have panels going along with it. But the films are first and foremost. They're two fantastic films. One from 2002 is Prisoner of Paradise, which Stuart Sender, one of the directors of the film, will be part of the panel afterwards, which is a harrowing story that really is the story of an artist who strove to survive within the confines of Nazi Germany. And it's very relevant to now, because so much of us, we're faced with this question of, do we confront what's going on? Do we try to find our way to continue to function? And then what happens? And the story of Prisoner of Paradise is a real lesson in what can happen. The other one is The Mortal Storm, real quickly, which is an MGM narrative film that was made in 1940 that was so provocative that it was banned from Germany. It's with Jimmy Stewart, and it is about the rise of fascism in a small Bavarian town and how that impacts on the people there.
I want to talk to you more about the films themselves, because I'm familiar with The Prisoner of Paradise, but I'm not familiar with The Mortal Storm. Perry, I wanted to talk to you about what brought you into this whole operation here.
Well, so I've been working with the group Refuse Fascism since, just before the inauguration. And we've in a lot of ways, that's clearly my viewpoint, that these guys are fascists and that we have to really confront this in a serious way. And that one of the aspects of fascism is that they don't respect the rule of law and they don't play by the rules, basically. So to put all your effort, a lot of people right now are putting their efforts into the midterms and trying to deal with this through the normal channels, which is, I can't argue that it's not something that people should be doing, but we have to confront what this really is. And on the other hand, it's clear that, like, as Dave said, this is coming much more into mainstream discussion, this question of fascism, but it's in a lot of people's minds, it's not an answered question. And the thing is, you can't just assert that that's what we're facing and expect everybody to go along with you. So Dave and I were talking about this, and the idea behind this was to really kind of create a forum where we could actually discuss this question. In a lot of what Refuse Fascism does, to some extent, I feel like the people who get it and join us. The people who don't get it for whatever reasons or have reservations or objections, it's hard to bring them into the fold. And the thing is, if doing something like this, using film, using art, using, creative activity, is a way to really sort of create a forum for dialogue. So this, as we were talking about this and planning it, originally we had hoped to do a whole film festival, and instead we sort of narrowed our focus a little bit to do this one event, and then hopefully that will be the first of a series. And the film festival, actually, I should mention, the initials for the film festival were FFFF, which stood for Fight Fascism Film Festival, or something I can't mention on the air. It had two alternative names. We started by compiling a list of films that we thought were relevant, and we have close to 100 films on that list now. And that, because actually this question, it's a much broader question than just what we're going through right now. It's a whole question about, people, citizens' roles in society and what our relationship with government is, the kinds of the forms that state rule takes. And when it shades over into something that can be properly called authoritarian or fascist. And, if you start to look at it, you start to realize that it figures largely in genres like science fiction. There's documentaries. There's a lot of narrative films from the Hollywood era, from the contemporary era. I mean, there's a lot of that's obviously come out of Germany, both if you look at the rise of fascism in the 30s, and then the aftermath of the Second World War, people dealing with what happened. It's just, it's so permeates kind of culture, both high art and popular culture, that this just seems like just a goldmine opportunity to really look at what's happening, to put it in a cultural context and bring people in to talk about it and really raise these questions in a real way and answer people's, you know, concerns about this and sort of figure out where we're going to go. So the first panel that we'll have will be primarily looking sort of back at history and looking at possible parallels and, you know, what's the same, what's different. I mean, one fact about fascism, it never happens the same way twice. So, you know, you have to confront this idea that this can't possibly be fascism because of this or this fact. You know, the state and corporate interests aren't working together in the same way they did in Germany or Italy or Spain. But on the other hand, it wasn't the same. You know, when it happened in Germany, there was no precedent for it in anything happening in exactly that way. So that's not really an objection. So you have to kind of see the context and then really ask this serious question of what, you know, what's the same, what's different. Then the second panel will look at going forward, what can we do and what do we need to do? And, you know, basically look at this question, can we do this through the electoral process? Are the midterms going to like make a difference? Is Mueller's investigation going to make a difference? Can we even survive till 2020 if nothing else happens? All of those questions need to be raised. And you know, I'll just also say one more thing, which is that I feel like that to reach people and to reach people in the numbers that we need to reach them, it's not one slogan is not going to do it. You know, one way of expressing this is not going to reach people. You have to use everything at your disposal, and different tactics are going to reach different people. Some people are going to be there because they love being in the streets and it's a chance to really make a change. Some people, it's because it's just so ridiculous and so absurd that this is happening that they just can't live with themselves and that, you know, until they do something. And then other people, you know, are really, they're going to raise their voices in different ways and they can be reached in different ways.
All right, let's dig into this. Let's dig into this, all right, because I think it's important to actually dig a little bit deeper into this. And I wanted to ask, Dave, I wanted to ask you something here. You know, it's like one of the things that's going on is when in the past, when Germany, when the fascists in Germany actually consolidated their rule, what happened, you know, the assault on humanity didn't actually unfold overnight or in a vacuum, you know, and with a sudden roundup, you know. It followed a well-calculated and implemented historical rewrite, as people were saying. And it's a slow but steady recast of entire people, stripping them of their history, culture, and collective purpose and decency. And you introduced me to one of the films that's going to be in this festival, which is The Prisoner of Paradise. And I'd like to talk about that in relation to that what I was just talking about, because I think it's really important in terms of people understanding that the questions that are going to be posed are very heavy questions that actually have a lot to do with the survival of the entire planet right now.
Yeah, this I think Prisoner of Paradise is a tremendous story to really kind of chew on right now, because it's a story of an artist, Kurt. God, I forgot his name already. I'm sorry. Kurt Guerin. I'm sorry. Who was a brilliant actor in Weimar Germany, Jewish actor, beloved. And his – at every step of the way as the Nazis, you know, consolidated their power, he strove to find a way to keep working. All he wanted to do was keep working. He wanted to act. He wanted to direct. He wanted to be able to practice his art. And that was it. He wanted to practice his art. And I think a lot of people can relate to this. And – I'm not going to reveal a lot about the actual story because it's fascinating. But he ended up making a propaganda film for the Nazis, extolling the Theresienstadt concentration camp, which was the Nazis. One of the things they did, they created this camp that they put artists and intellectuals in, and it was the only camp that they allowed the Red Cross to visit. They presented this camp to the world as being a paradise. And he took on the job of making a propaganda film about this paradise that was Theresienstadt. And this is while millions were being murdered, including most of the people from Theresienstadt in Auschwitz and other places. people look at this history of the Nazis, and it seems like everything was just obvious and everything was straightforward and simple, and it wasn't. And the fact that people like this great artist tried to find ways to accommodate themselves, and the tragic results of that, I have tremendous lessons for us today, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with filmmaker David Zeiger and artist Perry Hoberman about an important anti-fascist film screening that they're organizing called Is It Fascism? And What Can We Do About It? Two films and two panels. Now, Perry, are you familiar with The Mortal Storm in terms of can you tell us something about that?
So The Mortal Storm was this film that was made in 1940, and it's a Hollywood MGM movie with, kind of A-list actors, young Jimmy Stewart and Margaret Sullivan. And, I mean, in a lot of – it has some parallels to Prisoner of Paradise in that it really details the kind of the sort of process by which you try to accommodate the rise of fascism and basically different people take different, they have different reactions and more of them collaborate than not. But it's in a sense, kind of the moral lesson is that nobody knows what they're getting into when they make those compromises. The results are far beyond what they thought they could live with it. And I think that's really, that is the big question, because, in fact, if you think about just any of our lives more generally, we're always making, we don't have absolute freedom. We don't all get to do what we want. We have differences of opinion. We do have to accommodate disagreements and different points of view and so on. And that's just, part of life. But the point is that in certain circumstances, you have to kind of look at what those compromises actually lead to and where they're going. And we do have historical lessons for that. But as Dave said, though, it can be, these things can be quite gradual and they can sort of slip under the radar. And before, there are times like in Germany in the 30s where before you know it, it becomes too late or it becomes much, much more difficult to actually kind of, preserve things. And we feel like we're in a situation like that now. We certainly don't know all the details or all the answers, but it does feel like we're in this, really, really critical period where if things go the way they look like they're going, it could have very, very serious consequences, both for our country, but for the planet as a whole. And art and cinema are, because they sort of express things in a way that sort of stands the test of time and survives over decades and, basically, they're almost like time capsules or preserving something in amber where you can actually see what people thought at the time, how they responded, how they analyzed what had happened to them and so on. And you get a different perspective than you can possibly get just watching, CNN every day, where it's just like, one thing leads to another. And it all seems, it's hard to see the overall trajectory of history, and mm-hmm. art and cinema are a way of doing that.
Now, I have one thing. We have probably about, maybe five more minutes, a little bit less, maybe 4 minutes or something like that. So maybe each of you can throw in a 2-minute comment. But reading from the card for the whole event, it says, this year, the Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect warned of alarming parallels between Donald Trump and Hitler, likening the present day U.S. to the escalating steps of oppression that led to the Holocaust in the 1930s and 1940s. And join us for these powerful films, each followed by a panel of historians, educators, artists, and activists as we examine the most pressing question confronting the American people today. Is it fascism, and what do we do about it? Let's talk about that, the most pressing thing confronting American people today. And actually, people of the world, if you want to be frank about it. Mm-hmm. But go ahead. Mm-hmm. Dave, you first.
Well, I mean – for one thing, you have to look at the context of what's happening in this country and its role in the world and its domination of so much of the world and the determination certainly by – particularly by Trump but by everyone in that position to expand that domination, to expand American – American capitalism and fascism doesn't happen just in one country, and this is the thing that I think there's a lot of again parallels with what was going on in Germany at the time, because what was going on in Germany was going on in Europe as a whole, and we've seen the rise of all of these hyper-nationalist fascist movements. And you could, you know, and I've heard people say, well, but still the United States is the most democratic country when we live in here, et cetera, et cetera. But the problem is we're living in a world in which what happens in one country is going to have tremendous impact on the other countries. And this country has the power and the ability to wreak tremendous havoc on the world. And this is one of the things that I think people are the most terrified about Donald Trump and the Trump regime. It really requires us to look at this whole question that's being raised by people such as the Anne Frank Center of, is this actually leading towards, you know, a world conflagration similar to World War II? Is that really something that could possibly happen? And if so, we have to confront it.
Yeah, people have to confront that question. If so, what the hell are you going to do about it to stop it?
Yeah.
Perry, you have in 1 minute. Do you want to make a comment?
Yeah. So I just want to say this is happening. I mean, it's sad, but this is happening at a critical moment for humanity where we're just starting to understand the impacts of climate change it's worse than we thought. And the results of it already, things that scientists didn't think were going to happen for decades are happening now. And the thing is, that's a big part of the Trump regime is to discredit science and to stay on the side of corporations and the oil companies and so on. And that means, you know, so we're in some ways, this is like it's scarier than what was happening in Germany in the 30s, because it really, we're talking about the survival of humanity. And then finally, I just want to say, it's like a year ago, the word fascism was a dirty word. And whenever we brought it up, everyone complained that it was too strong and it was an epithet and all that. In just the last couple of weeks, it's been in the headlines of op-eds by Madeleine Albright and Paul Krugman, among others, in the New York Times, asking this question, is this fascism? And the thing is, when the Times, something like the Times, an institution like that, is asking that question, you know that it's a real question and it's something we really have to take seriously, because they're pretty conservative and pretty centrist, and they're even talking about it now.
Absolutely. And I want to really thank you for bringing that up. And I also want to say, and then we all have facing us is the question of what are we going to do about it? That's the big question. Perry, David, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
All right. And once again, folks,
thanks a lot, Mark.
Sure, Perry. This is the Anti-Fascist Film Festival, 2 films and 2 panels. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my board op today, Teddy Robinson and Henry Carson, my assistant producer, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. So we'll talk to you again next week.
What good is love and peace on earth when it's exclusive with the truth in the written word? If no one reads it, a new day dawning comes without warning. So don't think twice. We live in troubled times. We'll be right back.
exclusive.